I'll call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. We do have a quorum, although a couple people have checked in and had to run off to check into another committee. You have four sets of minutes in front of you, members, and I would like to approve all of those if possible. The first one is April 4th, 2005. Representative Dean moves the minutes of April 4th, 2005. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Emmer moves the minutes from April 5th, 2005. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The April 5th minutes are adopted. Representative Slawick moves the minutes from April 11th, 2005. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The April 11th minutes are adopted. And finally, Representative Lesh moves the minutes from April 12th, 2005. All those, any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The April 12th minutes are adopted. Our first bill on the agenda is House File 2187. Representative Abrams, welcome to the Civil Law and Elections Committee.
Mr. Chairman, it's always good to see somebody from the better half of Senate District 43 having a chairmanship of a committee such as Civil Law, and it's a pleasure to be here today. House File 2187 is the culmination, really, of 3 years of work between the Hennepin County Board and various stakeholders involved with the Hennepin County Medical Center. Hennepin County Medical Center, we heard a little bit of this on the floor yesterday, is a level one trauma center. It is probably the number one provider of indigent care in the state of Minnesota. It is also one of the premier teaching facilities in the state of Minnesota. In the increasingly competitive landscape of healthcare provision, it is getting very, very difficult for the county to own and operate a hospital. And what House File 2187 does is creates a county subsidiary corporation so that the hospital can
act. Representative Abrams. I'm sorry, members, I'm having a little trouble hearing. Go ahead, Representative.
So that the hospital can act more as a business and be able to make business decisions in a competitive environment. Now, when you go to this sort of model, you have a variety of stakeholders who are impacted, and that's what the 3 years has taken in order to try to stand off the rough spots in that relationship. When you take a look at the bill, you will see that there is a new board of directors appointed by the Hennepin County Board for the hospital rather than the board itself acting as the board of directors. You will see in here a wide grant of corporate powers to the new entity, and you will see particularly in Section 14, status of present employees, bargaining units, and retirement coverage, which has been carefully crafted to take into consideration not only the needs of the hospital to be competitive on a going forward basis, but also the legitimate concern of the employees to have a work environment and rights similar to the rights that they currently have. One reason that the bill is before the Civil Law Committee is Article 1, Section 19, is that it provides that the municipal tort liability statute applies to the corporation. Additionally, we are working through currently some of the open meeting law government data practices set issues. I understand that the Newspaper Association and Hennepin County are close to an agreement there. There's still some language differences. I'll certainly allow the parties to explain those differences, but at current we are not there. That is in a nutshell, is House File 2187. I would also point out for members of the committee that, you know, there are two other hospitals in the Twin Cities that provide a large amount of indigent care as part of their charter, if you will, and both of which have been subject to mergers in recent years. First would be Fairview University. University Hospital is now a part of the Fairview system, and the second would be Ramsey Regents Hospital. So what is going on here is, if you will, a Hennepin County answer to how do you have the hospital do all of its missions, indigent care, level one trauma, teaching mission, while at the same time be able to compete effectively in the current healthcare environment that we're facing. Be very happy to answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Abrams. Any questions for the author at this point? Representative Abrams, did you have any witnesses you would like?
I have with me Jeff Spartz, who is the CEO currently of the hospital, and Julie Belisle from AFSCME, who can talk a little bit about the nature of the agreement and the rather delicate nature of it, and why we're walking on eggshells a little bit.
Right. Representative Abrams, before you leave, are any of the amendments yours that you want us to put on?
There's one amendment, which is mine, which is the A4 amendment, which is a technical correction on issuing capital notes.
All right. Maybe, members, why don't we... actually, I don't think I ever moved the bill. The chairman will move House File 2187, be recommended to pass, and send to the Rules Committee. And I will also move the H2187A4 amendment to put it into the form that the author would like. Any discussion on the A4 amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Is it Mr. Spartz?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Spartz. I'm the administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. And very briefly this morning, I'll lay out the background made us look at this issue, what the major features of the bill are, what we intend to become, and also what is not intended. First of all, Mr. Chairman, over the last 7 years, state and federal reimbursements to Hennepin County Medical Center have dropped about $70 million due to changes in various pieces of public policy. We have been doing about one-sixth of the uncompensated care that is done in the entire state at Hennepin County Medical Center. And between 2003 and 2004, we saw a 38% increase in our total uncompensated care bill. It went from $23 million to about $31 million. And the number of uninsured patients we saw that year rose from 35,000 to about 46,000. So this puts incredible pressure on our budgets and our efforts to retain a qualified workforce and to be a major player in the educating of healthcare professionals that we've been in for many, many, many years. We have looked around at what's been happening in the rest of the country and what other models public hospitals under pressure have adopted, and the county board created two task forces. The first one looked at the issue, what the problems were and what some of the solutions might be. That task force of 14 people recommended two possible solutions. One would be converting to a 501(c), the other to a form of a public benefit corporation, which is a little bit less of a drastic change. The county board then asked a 5-member subgroup of that or outfit to further look at it for another year. They came to a conclusion that is essentially represented in this bill, which is some modest changes to the way that the medical center is governed. The primary goal was, in order to be competitive in this marketplace, was to take us out from under civil service systems with the complexities that they have, put us into a more healthcare competitive HR system. The second thing was to get an independent operating board that would have more expertise on it related to healthcare than the county board can provide. Other than that, the county board still has control over approving the operating budget, approving the capital budget, issuing the financing for anything that exceeds more than 1% of the operating budget for the hospital in terms of debt. We would be required annually, and we think this is important, to prepare a health service plan that describes what the hospital and the medical center would do for the community over the next year in terms of treating patients and improving the health status of the community. The county board would still contain or control ownership of the assets. The county board would still have the right, if they decided to, that it wasn't working properly, to dissolve the corporation and or replace the board of directors. And the county board also annually has to approve the board of directors for the following year. We think those are appropriate controls that help. And the final thing would be that only the county board can change the mission of the hospital. And that mission is primarily that we serve as a safety net, we teach medical professionals, and we support research that does the first two things in the mission. Having said that, we think that this provides for a better business model for us in these fairly tough economic times as we go forward. Something I should point out is that whether you're a nonprofit or a public hospital, which is basically what all hospitals in Minnesota are, you need to show a bottom line so that you've got money to reinvest in your people, your equipment, in your facilities. In the 6 years I've been the administrator in Hennepin County Medical Center, I've yet to be approached by a patient who says, I want Hugo health care. Everybody expects and wants first-rate health care. And if we're going to maintain the overall quality of health in this community, all of the hospitals have to have an adequate cash flow at the end of the year to provide for that reinvestment so that they're going concerns in the future. We are the third largest medical educator in the state for physicians. We're number one for undergraduate rotations, and we're number three for graduate rotations. And about 80% of the physicians we train stay in Minnesota somewhere to practice medicine after they complete their educational training. I think that's enough remarks, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Let me just point something out to committee members as well as the witnesses. I think what we have the most interest in this committee is on page 15, section 17, regarding data practices, and on page 17, as Representative Abrams pointed out, the tort liability piece, section 19 at the top. There is a lot more to this bill, obviously, and local government has already heard it. Those are the two that I would zero in on if there are questions. Any questions for Mr. Sparks? All right, Ms. Belisle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Belisle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, and I would like to concur with the comments made by Mr. Sparks and thank Commissioner Randy Johnson, Jeff Sparks, and Representative Abrams for addressing the concerns that we have on behalf of the public employees that work at Hennepin County. Number one, you have protected the public teaching and research mission of Hennepin County. You have provided for PELRA protections for existing and new employees, and you have provided for PARA protections, pension protections for existing and new employees. And those were very important issues to the union employees at Hennepin County, and we totally support the agreement that's before you as is. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Belisle. Any questions for Ms. Belisle? Is there anyone who would like to testify against this bill? Yes, sir. Come on up. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Anthonson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, the trade association of all the newspapers in the state. I am not really testifying against this bill. I think the bill is a good proposal, a creative one, to modernize the way that HCMC operates is probably to the benefit of all the people in Minnesota. Our concern is Article 1, Section 17. Because even though the proponents of this bill, and this is the fifth committee I've heard their testimony in, concede that this will continue to be a major public institution with lots of public stake in how they perform their duties and lots of public money directly and indirectly supporting the operation, this bill completely exempts the new facility from the open meeting law and the Data Practices Act. In other words, it gives this entity a complete exemption from the two laws that for 40 years this legislature has committed itself to in terms of allowing the public some direct ability to hold public institutions accountable. In effect, there's virtually no public body or institution in this state that has an exemption from these laws such as this. And yet it's being proposed for what is unquestionably one of the most important public institutions in the state. It's really quite a breathtaking departure, and it breaks faith with the people of the state of Minnesota. It is simply not enough to think that government can always capably regulate itself without some public visibility, transparency, and input. Now, we have talked at length with the proponents of the bill, and for a while we were hopeful that we could work out a measure that would strike a compromise on this issue. In fact, as recently as yesterday, we had offered and discussed with them in some detail a very generous amendment that would allow this entity very broad discretion in deciding when it needed to restrict access to records and when it needed to restrict access to meetings. And that has now been refused as well, and we're back to no public access. The committee should understand that this kind of an exemption goes well beyond the interests of my clients, for example, of meddling in the business of this public body. By completely exempting this entity, for example, from the open records law, it means that no citizen will have any rights to get anything from this entity, including all kinds of records that have nothing to do with the competitive position, records that deal with medical care, training, treatment, competency. They'll have no rights to any of that. Again, this is a breathtaking, unprecedented exemption for a public body in the state. Something better can be achieved than this, I must believe. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Anthonson. Representative Abrams, I tend to agree with that testimony, and you made a comment in your introduction that this is being worked on. Could you just clarify that further so we understand?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I don't want to say that during this process I have been an empty vessel, but to some extent I've been a vessel trying to bring the parties together. After local government, I know that representatives of the Newspaper Association and Hennepin County have been trying to reach an agreement. The language, I guess, doesn't quite meet what Hennepin County is looking for. I would like to have Mr. Scandrett perhaps tell you where they are deficient. I am not necessarily wedded to every semicolon and apostrophe in the bill, but I do want to be able to bring the parties together, and I would suspect that that this issue is going to have to be dealt with before final passage. But as to specific objections to the language that's currently been proposed by the Newspaper Association, I believe Mr. Scandrett can fill you in a little bit more fully, Representative Emmer.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Sir, could you introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm helping Hennepin County with this legislation. And I do respect what Mr. Anderson has said about it. We have been working a lot with them. We have some unique things that I need to bring to your attention that are in the bill, and that is that a great deal of the decisions regarding the major policy matters are continue to be the responsibility of the county board, which is subject to the open meeting law and the Data Practices Act. So what we have is a lot, all those major decisions about indigent care, about services to the community, about the budget, about the relationship of the hospital to the community are all in a health services plan or in a budget that moves up from the hospital corporation to the county board. And then at the point at which the county board discusses and approves those, it is subject to all the requirements of the Data Practices Act and the open meeting law. In addition, the bill lists a number of things that are required to be disclosed and also specifies that certain meetings are going to be public for the purposes of discussing things of importance to the community and also to allow public input on things affecting the hospital. As far as the objections to the current language, the language that's being proposed by the Newspapers Association, really the two options are what they're proposing is to make the organization, the subsidiary, subject to both of the laws, and then create an opportunity for the corporation, if they can show that there would be harm to the hospital in releasing information or holding a meeting open, that they could then close the meeting or withhold the information. And the opinion of attorneys and others involved were that this would open the corporation to a lot of legal challenges around whether something would be of harm to the corporation or not, and also that the types of persons that would serve on this new hospital board, which are experts from the community that we want to voluntarily serve to bring the kind of expertise that is needed, have indicated, some of those that would be candidates, that they would not be interested in serving on a board of this type if they're doing it in kind of the fishbowl. And again, this is the point at which strategic decisions would be developed as recommendations that would go to the county board and then be subject to full accountability to the public, both for the information and for the meetings. So that's why we have not been able to kind of get to that final agreement. It's a matter of whether you make those laws apply and then allow an exception that the hospital would have to demonstrate, or whether you create the exception and then specify those things that must be subject to public meetings and disclosure.
Emmer and then Ellison.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I've already forgotten your name. I was listening to your testimony. Sir, you're leaving out one very important word in your response. You keep referring to the corporation, but you're leaving out the word public, because this is not a private corporation. This is going to be a public corporation. And I tend to strongly disagree with you when you believe that just because the county board is going to be subject to these open meeting rules and the open process, that somehow should absolve this public corporation from the same responsibilities. Now, I respect the author who I spoke with beforehand briefly, who said that there's going to be an effort to work this out, but I will tell you from my perspective, people who don't want to serve on a board because they're not willing to be subject to public scrutiny, maybe you don't want them on the board. All right, it's a public institution. They should be, just like we are around this table, we should be ready, willing, and prepared to respond to anybody for any decision or any statement that we make. So I would encourage you to go back and work with these folks and get some agreement with the newspapers that works for everybody.
Mr. Chairman, I have a point. Mr. Standard has a point. Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, this bill not only has to go to rules, but it has to go to the floor. And I can assure you that this author does not want to have a two-hour conversation on the floor about data practices and the open meeting law. So I would expect that between now and the floor that an agreement will be reached, and that will be one of the things that I'm going to be asking the county to do in the newspaper association between now and the floor. You know, this bill has enough controversial issues around it. I would like to think nonpartisan controversial issues around it, that we don't have to be into these issues.
And I just, Mr. Chair, I should have mentioned earlier on, too, that the real issue here is that the Hennepin County Medical Center will have to compete with other hospitals in the metro area, none of whom are subject to it. So we understand it's a really difficult balance here of wanting to be able to allow the new corporation to talk about strategic alliances that they may need to form in the community, how they can negotiate better deals to bring in business, bring in patients, how they can think about what the future is going to be like and assess their competitors. So the balance is the need to be able to allow them to compete and not be subject to all their competitors coming to all their meetings and knowing exactly what they're thinking about and how they're assessing their performance and who they're going to partner with, and yet still wanting to have a great deal of accountability. So we will, as the author said, we'll commit to continuing to work, and we really do appreciate all the work that has already gone into trying to get close to a compromise, and we'll just continue to see if we can find a solution before it gets to the floor. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, very briefly, please.
Yeah, I just want to be clear that, as Representative Abrams suggests, he has not been the problem. He has been helpful and responsive. He has never rejected our compromise. This has been between the proponents of the bill and us. And based on the comments today, I will remain optimistic that something can be worked out. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer hit a lot of the points I wanted to make on this issue. I just want to let you folks know, Representative Abrams, that I think he's absolutely right. I'm particularly concerned that this is a new thing for us. So we're going to take this brand new thing and automatically say that it's not subject to the open meeting law. When it very well, this is exactly when we should have as much public input as possible. I read in the language says that there shall be one meeting per year that's open to the public. Well, I mean, if I was trying to not disclose things to the public, I'd make that the nice meeting where we didn't talk about everything, you know, pass out lollipops, nice meeting. But my point is that I'm not going to go on because I think he covered it amply, and I got some other things I want to take up in a little while. So,
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, I'm on the same page. In fact, I'm sitting here thinking this is part of why you come to committee, to have things worked out before it goes through committee. And the author has said he is fully committed to making the parties come together. And so, but just so the parties know, and Representative Abrams, I'd be more inclined to lay this bill over and let the parties see if they're going to come to an agreement before the floor, because it's easier to have some control over seeing that the data privacy things get addressed. And I think Representative Emmers does make a good point. The one witness forgets to put the word public in front of corporation. So I'm open to the chair's deference here, Mr. Chair, but just so the audience or the two parties for sure know that I'd side in with the Representative Ellis and Emmers, and my guess is more of the committee would do so as well. So hopefully, Representative Abrams, that gives you lots of mediation authority to bring the parties together, and hopefully we can see that by the floor.
Representative Westrum, I appreciate that. I would prefer not to lay it over. I'm assuming the author would prefer not to lay it over at this point, and I will trust him to push this issue forward. Hopefully we'll have it worked out by the floor. Mr. Carlson, did you have some testimony as well? Why don't you
come
forward? Thanks, Mr. Anderson.
Thanks.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I have a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. Again, similar to Mr. Anderson, not necessarily to testify against the concept or the bill in its entirety, but do have some questions about the language and how it may operate in the future as it relates to liability for the new corporation, and in particular subsidiaries or other entities that they may incorporate. Mr. Chairman and members, on page 4, starting at line 23, it requires the county board to create bylaws, and then it reserves to the county board certain aspects of those bylaws that that the corporation cannot amend without getting county board approval. One of those requirements is that is the ability of the corporation to create subsidiaries would appear to need to come back to the county board. It then goes on to, on page 5, line 10, detail what the authority and powers of the new board are, and they include most things that corporations would engage in, including setting levels of compensation and benefits as recommended by the administrator, a number of other items, and then on, and most importantly for my purposes, twofold. It authorizes, in fact, encourages the new board to recruit and retain physicians whose services are necessary or desirable for meeting the health care needs of the population. And then further, on page 6, line 27, it authorizes them to incorporate other corporations, both for-profit and non-profit. And my question that I have, Mr. Chairman and members, it is not clear to me how the liability is handled for any corporation, profit or nonprofit, that this board may incorporate. And here's my concern. if right now it's our understanding or our belief that most of the physicians that work at HCMC are not necessarily employed by HCMC, although some of them may be. Most of them work for some other clinic or Hennepin faculty associates. They are not subject to Chapter 466 municipal tort liability caps and immunity. Our concern is that we may, and I want to make a record of it because I don't think this is their intention, but our concern is that this new board would be able to incorporate a new corporation not subject to other requirements, not subject to the, for example, the public salary limitation at 15A.082, which is a principal reason why physicians aren't working for HCMC because of the salary limitation. They work for some other entity. And so our concern is that they are able to form and incorporate a new corporation that would be governed by this board or by some other board, and then somehow pick up Chapter 466 municipal liability protections. I don't believe that that is necessarily the intent, but that is certainly a potential outcome. And, Mr. Chairman, following on the bill, what heightens my concern is on page 11, line 1 through 19, it talks about any corporation or any employee employed at the corporation is subject to certain personnel requirements, veterans preference, pay equity. It does not include Municipal Statute 115A.082, which deals with the salary compensation level. They are not subject to that under this requirement. Further, Mr. Chairman and members, on page 13, this just confirms that earlier point. On page 13, line 29, any subsidiary created by the corporation shall be subject to the same human resources requirements as those that apply to the corporation under subdivision 1, but that does not include the salary limitation. And so our concern is that you can create a subsidiary that now retains the physicians that work at HCMC that now pick up the Chapter 466 municipal liability cap, which is currently not the case. And, Mr. Chairman, finally, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Finally, on page 17, lines 3 through 6, it talks about the corporation shall be a municipality for purposes of tort liability pursuant to Chapter 466. It doesn't specifically say its subsidiaries. It doesn't specifically say any corporation that is formed by the corporation. And it is not clear who is now picking up this 466 protection. To the extent the status quo remains and those that are covered by 466 at HCMC currently retain that protection, we don't have an objection. To the extent that this is a vehicle to now bring into municipal tort liability a broad range of physicians and other employees that are not currently covered, whether it's to encourage or retain physicians or to reduce costs, we have a significant problem if that is what this new vehicle is used for. And just so that we're clear, we're talking about the issue here is a hard cap of $300,000 per incident for any instance of medical malpractice that may take place. So it's a significant issue for Minnesotans and families that are treated at HCMC, which are not currently subject to that limitation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Be happy to answer any questions.
Before we do that, maybe since you posed a couple questions as to intent, I would ask either Representative Abrams or Mr. Scanrett to specifically address the issue of the creation of new corporations in Chapter 466.
Why don't I let Mr. Scandrick go first, Mr. Chairman, and then I may have a few remarks to make.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the first we've heard of these concerns, and we had talked to the trial lawyers a month or so ago, and it's clearly not the intent of the legislation, nor do I believe it's the legal effect of the legislation to extend protection from liability in anything beyond the current status quo, which is the public hospital being protected from liability as a municipality. So I'd be happy to talk with Mr. Carlson after the meeting. It's, again, not the intent nor the effect to do any of the things that he brought up. And had we known about the concerns, we could have either explained those or worked on clarifying language to correct those problems. We'll do so after this meeting as we can.
Representative Abrams?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Mr. Scandrett. The bill has literally been out there for a while, and this is the first I heard of this issue. And second, as I consider the issue, it is a rather tortured and convoluted argument. It is not the intent, and I don't think that the language does that, personally.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, both contacted Mr. Abrams' office on this specific issue and spoke to his legislative assistant and brought the issue up with Mr. Griffin when the bill was in local government. And I grew up in the era of Ronald Reagan. They told me that was what the answer was, but I believe in trust verify. I want it on the record that they are not going to insert the Hennepin Faculty Associate Doctors into any new subsidiary or corporation that would be created under this, and I want to merely create a legislative record that that is not the intent. I don't think the language is that clear as it relates to them being able to establish and create new corporations and subsidiaries, and that's why I wanted to create the record.
Representative Emmer.
Let me ask this. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against this bill? Please raise your hand if there is. All right, discussion to the bill. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I have a few amendments I'd like to offer.
All right. Let me add this, too. I would like to vote on this bill by 10 o'clock so that we would still at least have a tiny hope of finishing the more difficult bill before session starts. So that is my goal. So if we can move through these rather quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, first I'd like to take up the HDA-072 amendment.
Okay. Senator Ellison moves the 072 amendment.
So I'll move that. Mr. Chair, members, if you go to page 7 under section 5 where we discuss the question, the bill discusses the question of financial oversight, the county board shall approve the annual budget of the corporation and receive an annual audited financial statement also from the corporation. What this amendment would do was to also have in that annual budget how efficiencies and revenues contribute to stabilizing and reducing county liabilities for indigent care. What we'd like to know is if we're moving to this new model, in order to have a more efficient way of governing, more efficient business sort of way of operating the hospital, I think it's important to see in that budget how this these new efficiencies impact indigent care. So we would just ask that that be put in. And then also in a similar fashion and in concert with that, if you skip ahead to line 16, what we'd also like to see in line 32, but the same amendment, by the way, is in the health services plan, we believe the health services plan should include a section that on how the services to improve the health status of the community, including indigent populations. So we think those things should be included, because traditionally, you know, Hennepin County Hospital has had a role in dealing with indigent communities and populations, and so it's important to, you know, have some sort of public reporting as to how we're doing with that. So it seems like a simple, straightforward amendment, and we request support from the committee.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, in thinking about this amendment, Representative Ellison, one of the reasons that the county is doing this is to provide more flexibility and more resources to provide indigent care. I think having language in the bill to bring the county board back to that and to bring the new entity back to that on an annual basis really is a pretty good idea. So I would agree to the amendment. There may be some word changes that may be needed down the road, but I think that this is a concept that ought to be put in the bill.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellingson, help me understand on the first part of your amendment, page 7, line 33.
Yeah.
You're putting this with the budget in. Would you not want those management statements as part of the audit rather than at the front end? Or help me understand that, if you would, please.
Representative Ellison.
Well, here, let me get right there. I mean, you know, this is in the section of the bill dealing with financial oversight. And in the course of the conversion, what we're hoping to gain is greater efficiencies. So what I'm hoping is that the budget will address how efficiencies and revenues contribute to stabilizing and reducing the liabilities for indigent care. So I think it is a proper budget item. I mean, I'm not wedded to the concept. If you and I could get together and figure out, okay, maybe it should be here or there. As I reviewed the bill last night with the help of Representative Loeffler, we figured it should go here. If you say, hey, it should go there, I'm not against that, but I think that my main point is that we need to keep our eye on the ball as it relates to indigent care, and I'd be open to looking at different places it might go, but as long as the author's not opposed to it. So I that's my best shot at this point, Representative Nelson, and if you think there's another place it should go, I'd be open to that.
Mr. Chairman, so I don't use up more committee time, and I will talk with the author and Representative Ellison on this.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the 072 amendment? All right, the amendment is before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The 072 amendment is adopted. Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, I got another one. It's the 070 amendment, and I'd like to move that amendment and go to page 3, members of the bill. And on line 5, we go up to line 5, and now we're talking in the section regarding governance. Well, the subdivision 1 is governance. Subdivision 2 further elaborates on governance, term, quorum, manner of acting. And what we'd like to put in here as a subdivision 3 is qualifications for board members. Now, we're not trying to tell the board what everybody should do. And we're not even trying to say that one person could not fulfill more than one of these qualifications. But in terms of board governance, I think, and I think, again, you know, I got to give a lot of credit to Representative Loeffler on this, because she's a tremendous experience in this area. But I'm fully convinced that the board of the corporation should include people who have an eye on the uninsured and urban, that's the possibility of being excluded. We should have somebody who has an eye toward, medical practitioners, including doctors, nurses, and PAs, people like that. And there should be somebody who's on the board who represents the interests of the employees. And, this is a big change. And, members, it's possible that you may have one person on the board who fulfills all these criteria. You may have three people. But this is a 15-member board we're talking about, so we're not trying to prescribe exactly who could be on the board. But I just think it would be a serious problem, particularly given the open meeting problem issues we talked about before. It would be a problem if we didn't have somebody who was looking at the governance issues from the eyes of employees and labor, somebody who's looking at the deal from the ideas of the medical practitioner, and somebody who's looking at it from the eyes of the uninsured. Because, again, you know, if what we're trying to do, members, is gain financial efficiency and run this thing more, quote-unquote, like a business, as we commonly say nowadays, you know, there is the, you know, running things like a business is good in that we get more efficiencies, but it also has a bad side. And the bad side is that maybe in our drive to improve profitability, cut costs, we lose sight of some other important things that a public hospital should maintain. And so this language is just to guide board selection to say we need to have some people on the board with these ideas in mind.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, I know that a copy of this tape will be probably asked for by the seven Hennepin County commissioners when I get through with what I'm about to say. At times you have to trust the elected county commissioners in Hennepin County to make the right decision. They don't always do it, but I believe that in this instance that the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners will, during their initial process of selecting board members through the nominating committee that's provided in the bill, we'll keep some of the concerns that Representative Ellison has raised and Representative Loeffler have raised and others have raised in mind. What concerns me is that once we start down the path of saying that you have to have somebody with this expertise and that expertise, all of a sudden you're going to have 10 of the 15 members of the board in slots. So I would ask members to vote against Representative Ellison's amendment. Not that the board shouldn't keep, not that the Hennepin County Board shouldn't keep these in mind, Representative Ellison, as they go forward.
Any further discussion on the amendment?
It looks like we're ready to vote, but I just want to say that again, the board must include people with this experience. They could be all in one. One person can have all this experience. Or we can have three people. I just think we're going down a new path here, and you know how about trust? You know, trust is fine, but somebody said trust to verify, and you know, I'm a little concerned, and I want to make sure that these three areas at least are looked upon. There may be others, but these are the only three we have now, and I ask members to, you know, rather than, you know, buy into the slippery slope argument that, oh, if we get these three, what about three more? This amendment just has three. And so I ask you to evaluate this on its own merit as opposed to looking down the line. Thank you, and I urge your support.
Any further discussion? All right, we're on the HDA 070 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Got one more, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Ellison.
Now, I hope you guys really like this one. this is the 066 amendment, and I'd like to guide you to page 3 and on line 8. Now, appointment of board members. This question of governance is the big enchilada for the community that I represent. If the county board isn't going to be running it anymore, who is this new board? You know, I'm concerned when this new board is going to be voted on by slate. It says here in the on page starting on page 10. No. Let me move up page 8. Let me just start from the beginning of the paragraph. The county board shall appoint the initial board of the corporation. Fine, no problem. Thereafter, the county board shall appoint directors of the corporation by slate. Now, when we select people to be regents or anything like that, we have the right to vote the slate or not. I think that I'm not trying to deprive the county of the right, the county board of the right to put people on the board by the corporation board by slate. They can certainly do that, but I don't think that we should put in statute that it must be by slate. I think that it's important. We need to pick these folks one at a time. And maybe there'll be a slate, maybe there won't be, maybe it'll be slate except so-and-so. But I think it's dangerous when, you know, we get together beforehand as a county board and we say we get those folks on the board who, and we have to take them or leave them as a group. When one may be good and the rest may be bad, or one may be bad and others may be good. I just don't think it provides for public confidence. It could definitely foster the idea that the hospital board is going to be led by, you know, insiders, people with special access, people who don't necessarily have the public interest in mind and are too focused on certain issues. And I just think for public confidence, public inclusion that it is not necessary for the slate language to be here. And I think that whatever few moments of time it may save to actually pick them one by one, that the public confidence we gain by allowing the county board to be selected not as a slate but as individuals, or the hospital board to be as individuals, it would more than make compensate for any time savings of just doing it by a slate. And then finally, you know, I just want to add that, you know, they can do it by slate if they want to, but I just think it's a bad idea to statutorily prescribe that it must be a slate. And I think for openness, inclusion, access, and accountability, it should not be statutorily limited to a slate procedure.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, I would oppose the amendment. This has been subject to great negotiation by the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. All seven of them support the language in the bill, as I understand it. Maybe it may be helpful if Commissioner Johnson, the chair of the Hennepin County Board, speaks to the amendment. I will point out that there are removal provisions in Subdivision 4. In addition, there is the ability of the board to remove the new corporations board in its entirety, but Commissioner Johnson can give you a little bit more history of this provision.
Welcome, Chairman.
Thank you.
If you could introduce yourself for the record and then give us your brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Randy Johnson. I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner, and I'm chair of the Hennepin County Board. You know, the best way, Representative Ellison, I think, of accomplishing what you were trying to do with your last amendment is actually by having a slate to make sure that all of these are balanced. I appreciate the opportunity to give the county board flexibility, because I always appreciate that opportunity. But I really think in the long run, the slates is the better way to go to accomplish what I think you and I both want to accomplish in a very balanced board on for the hospital.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, thank you for coming here. I appreciate you taking your time to come down here and help us work through these. Could you give me some sense in the committee why a slate is the way to go here? I can't think of why we need a slate, and I also think that if the slate language were removed, you could still do a slate. It's just that you wouldn't have to do it. Could you give us some history as to the whole slate discussion?
Commissioner Johnson. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I think it's to accomplish what you sought to do with your amendment, to get a real balance. I could come up with about five more categories of people. You know, somebody who can read a public hospital balance sheet, somebody who understands how to deal with federal government and dish payments. It's a matter of trying to get that balance, and I think the slate is the better way to go, and the board votes it up or down. It gets away from each commissioner saying, well, this is my appointment to the board. I think we all agree we don't want that. What we want is representation of the entire community, finance, medical expertise, indigent care. I just think the slate is the way that allows the board to do that best.
Well, I'm still thinking about it. I might even withdraw the amendment given what you just said, Commissioner Johnson. But going back to the amendment that was just defeated, I think that the money folks are going to be there. The accountants, I mean, we're doing this to save money. So the people who understand balance sheets and finance and healthcare finance, they're going to be there. There's no doubt they're going to be there. Who's likely to be left out? People who speak up for the uninsured, people who speak up for the doctors and the medical practitioners, people who speak up for labor and employees. That's who the most likely suspects are to be left out of the table, because the people who are real keen on the financial considerations, you know, they always seem to get to the table one way or another. But I guess, you know, my concept of the slate is that, you know, if we do see a slate and we have somebody here who represents banking and somebody who represents the downtown business interests and somebody who represents, you know, the big mega hospitals and somebody who represents accounting, and then that's our slate, you know, maybe if we do take away the slate language, maybe the public can come back and say, wait a minute, Representative Johnson, I mean, Commissioner Johnson, I know you meant to include folks on indigent care, but somehow they didn't get there. Can we do something with this mix? And so if I'm willing to, not necessarily offer this slate amendment at this time. I do reserve the right to offer it later, but that'll depend on, how things go from here. But, I do want to just say that the people who represent financial interests always get to the table. It's the other folks who often get left behind, and that's what I was trying to accomplish with this amendment. And I may offer it again. I'm not trying to tell you that I'm not going to offer it, but Mr. Chair, I don't think I need to offer it at this time.
All right. Representative Ellison withdraws the HDA 066 amendment. To the bill, and then we will vote. Representative Emmer.
This is to the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Mr. Sparks. All the talk earlier about what could happen based on the language, I didn't see it. But thinking about the subsidiary issue that was brought up earlier, is there any plan at this point to put Hennepin Faculty Associates into some subsidiary?
Mr. Sparks. Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, there is no plan at this time, but I'm not going to say that it could not, based on events that would occur in the future, be considered at some point in the future.
Mr. Chairman, and just so I'm clear then, Mr. Sparks, because I didn't see it, and I think Representative Abrams pointed out that wasn't the intent. The intent wouldn't be to somehow create this tort issue that was brought up earlier.
No, Mr. Sparks, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Emmer, there's not an intent to create a tort issue, tort liability issue. Mr. Carlson, when he raised that issue, I had not even thought about that to that point.
Thank you. All right, members, I think we're ready to vote on the bill. I will renew my motion that House File 2187, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to thank the 3 television networks and 2 radio networks that carried this hearing.
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of my colleagues on the board, could you ask your committee clerk to provide us with a tape of this so that I can...
I'm sure you'll get it.
Representative Abrams' comments.
All right. On to House File 2428, Representative Howes. The chairman will move House File 2428 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. And members, we all know that this is the Minnesota Personal Protection Act. Let me just set forth some ground rules so that we're not here all day. Here is what I would like to do, and this is at least similar but not exactly the same as what we did with the marriage amendment. We're going to allow 45 minutes on the pro side. We're going to allow 45 minutes on the con side. When 45 minutes is up, if someone is talking, I'm going to ask them to finish, and that side will be done. I will allow either or both sides to reserve some of their 45 minutes for a rebuttal after the other side is completed, but only once for each side. We can ask questions of witnesses after they speak. All I would ask is that you be courteous, because that will count towards their 45 minutes. So I would expect that neither side tries to use up the time of the other side by asking a whole bunch of questions. But if you do have questions while they're speaking, I will allow that. I will also, and then we'll have 45 minutes at the end for our discussion. I will allow, if members want to ask a question of one of the witnesses at that point, I will allow them to come back and answer those questions during that 45-minute discussion, and then we are going to vote on this bill. It's possible we could get it done by noon, but we'll see.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smallwood.
As to the rules, obviously 45 and 45 is more than session starting at noon, so that is one comment. But on the rebuttal process is a bit new to, I had never heard of that before in legislative committees. For the other side that's going second, can they rebut at the end of theirs?
What I would do is the pro side goes, the con side goes. If both of them reserved some time, the pro side would come in and use up any portion of their time, and then the con side would come in and do the same, and then we'd be done.
Okay.
I'm not going to let rebuttals keep going on, but if either side chooses to reserve some time, they can use it at the end.
And, Mr. Chair, if we run short on time for committee?
If we are still discussing and not ready to vote at about 5 minutes to 12, we will adjourn or we will recess and come back after session and finish up.
Thank you.
Representative House, sorry, the bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is an amendment. I'd like to put that on first, if I may.
Is that the A1 amendment, Representative House?
I have A050704.
All right. I will move the A050704 amendment. And what does this do, Representative House?
It deletes lines 15 and 16 on the bill. And it explains better what we're attempting to do here today. And it's because and I will read the amendment because it's short. Because Laws 2003, Chapter 28, has been found to be unconstitutional by the Court of Appeals due to a violation of Section 17, Article 4 of the Minnesota Constitution regarding the enactment of that chapter, then Laws 2003, and then we go back to the bill, are reenacted, effective immediately.
Right. This will put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion on the amendment? To the 0704 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know many people come before your committee members and witnesses and say this is really a simple bill. What I have before you is a simple bill, but it ties into things that may be controversial to some and passionate for others. What this bill does is when the governor signs it, it will reenact the Citizens Personal Protection Act of 2003 with one small word change, Mr. Chairman and members. And that would be on page 2 of the bill, line 15. We changed the infamous and to an or. So a business, rather than having to post a sign and notifying a person that guns were not allowed on their premises, they can do either or. They can either post a sign or they can tell someone that they would prefer not to have a weapon on their premises. That is my bill in its entirety, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Cornish will have a few words to say, and then we will bring two witnesses forward at this time and reserve some of our time for the end.
All right. Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair and members, my purpose here is for moral and technical support. I've been working on gun legislation since before some, especially probably the pages were born in here. In 1975, I went to Washington as an NRA lobbyist, and I worked on the current law that we were under before the Personal Protection Act instituted back in 1975, and I lobbied and was on the balcony of the House of Representatives when that was voted through by a couple of votes. I've held my interest since then, and I will be able to, if called on today, we will save it mostly for our testifiers, but offer you some expertise in the background of law enforcement. I was a peace officer for 27 years and can give you some background in how it affects law enforcement if that comes up. So with that, I would like to have our testifiers come up and make their presentation.
All right. Thank you, members. The first testifier we have is John Cale. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cale. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please, and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Cale. I'm Communications Director for Concealed Carry Reform Now and also for the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I'm also a real estate agent and a certified firearms instructor. We all know why we're here. I'm not going to debate the pros and cons or the merits of the court's decision. In our system of government, the court's decision rules. We are therefore able to resubmit this bill, and there are many good reasons to do so. The court decision really didn't change much. We now have 27,000 and some odd permits issued under the Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act, all still valid. Personally, I have no dog in this hunt. My permit is good till 2008. I'm here on behalf of the people who will now be thrown back into an archaic system whereby blatant and wanton discrimination is exhibited against honest, law-abiding, hardworking citizens who simply want to protect themselves. I can think of no better example than just recently a veteran, a decorated combat veteran, after 15 months in Iraq, comes back to Minnesota, tries to get a carry permit, and the chief of police of St. Paul, through his representatives there, basically spit in his face, wouldn't even give him an application. And when he went back, they finally gave him an application, and in the time it took to mail it in and get it back, he was denied. This is why the Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act was implemented in the first place. You can argue all day long whether you like guns or not. It's not the issue. The issue is fair and non-discriminatory issue of permits. I support this reenactment of the Personal Protection Act for a variety of reasons, but plainly and simply, it's worked. The debate went on for 8 years. We now have experience. We're coming up on the second year anniversary with the citizens who've obtained permits not merely behaving well, but extraordinarily well, with about one or two tiny exceptions. Permit holders have been virtually invisible. If you talk to citizens today and ask them how much, which I do, by the way, I go into businesses all the time, how much has the carry permit law affected your life? They shrug their shoulders. Not a bit. Doesn't bother you? Heck no. People are probably carrying. I don't care. Sure, you'll find if you dig hard enough and you run a survey over at the University of Minnesota among a bunch of professors, you'll find people who wring their hands and say, oh, they're frightened of this or frightened of that. But the reality is, we go about our business. We go to restaurants. We go shopping. We do all the things that Minnesota people have always done. The law has worked. It wasn't broke, but we still have to fix it anyway. So I urge the members of this committee to pass this bill. Pass it soon, and let's get back to fair and non-discriminatory issuance of permits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kale. And just as we did with the debate on the marriage amendment, I'm not going to ask after every testifier whether there are questions. If you want to question someone, just speak up, please.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Was there actually a veteran spat upon, or were you just saying that for dramatic effect? Did that really happen? Somebody guess.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, what would you call it when a decorated combat veteran goes in, asks for a permit, and is laughed at, not given an application, and only when he called me and told me about it did I tell him it was his legal right to at least get an application? If you're going to quibble about my choice of words, I'm sorry. I beg your forgiveness.
Mr. Chair, I'm not quibbling. You said he was spat upon. You weren't joking, laughing when you said it. I thought that really actually occurred, and I was trying to verify whether that's true.
Mr.
And I think, I'm not done, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not going to, I'm going to take all witnesses seriously, and if they're engaging in hyperbole, that's fine. I just want to know it. And so, if he was laughed at or spat upon, I mean, the point is he was denied a permit. That's what you're saying.
Oh.
And I think that if he was denied a permit or not allowed to get his permit, that's fine. That's good information for us to rely on. But I think that inflammatory exaggeration is not useful to me as a person who's going to be called upon to vote today. And if you were just saying, hey, and that was a matter of speaking, fine, as a matter of speaking. But you said spat upon as if, in fact, it occurred, and I wasn't sure whether it really happened or not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, as one who has had to endure the most inflammatory rhetoric from the anti-gun activists in this state, I find that question almost beside the point. But if you want a clarification, it is this. He was not merely denied a permit. He was refused an application and told, with a smirk and a laugh by the officer in question, forget it, the chief doesn't believe in permits, quote unquote. Now, if you want to spend the next 10 minutes arguing if that's hyperbole or inflammatory, that's fine. My point is, it is absolutely atrocious that a combat veteran should be treated that way.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move on, but I would simply like to ask the witness to engage in factual information that we can use to make a decision. Exhibiting, you know, anger or hostility because of what happened to you in the past, which I don't know anything about, is understandable that you'd feel upset, but
it simply isn't useful in this form for me as a decision maker. And I don't know if you were treated badly or not, but I can tell you that it's not persuasive to me to want to vote on behalf of your bill to hear about how, you know, you're angry because you weren't treated properly. And by who, I don't know. I mean, we can keep doing this. I mean, I'm pretty stubborn, too. So, you know.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, I wasn't referring to how I was treated.
Well, you just said you were treated badly.
Representative Ellison,
no. I was referring to a veteran was treated badly.
Okay, why don't we move on? Thank you, Mr. Gale. Joe Olson is the next person. I'm sorry, Representative Simon. Do you have
yes,
questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly.
Mr. Gale. Mr. Gale, I'm sorry. Representative Simon had a question.
Thank you. I wasn't here last time this debate occurred. I'm a rookie here, but I just want to get a little bit of a flavor about the origins of this particular law, really, in 2003. It seems to me what you're saying, and I've heard this before, but clarification would be helpful, that there's some pattern of discrimination, or at least randomness, in the granting of permits by law enforcement. Do I have that pretty much correct from your standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, prior to 1975, there was no permitting system. All you needed to carry a gun in Minnesota was a gun. There was a what's called discretionary permit system implemented. Under that, the law enforcement authority issuing permits was allowed to basically decide to give you a permit or not. There were no strict guidelines of any kind. Thus, we've had about 2.5 million people in the outstate, 2.5 million people in the 7-county metro, 90% of the permits given in the outstate, only 10% of the permits in the metro. Since the Minnesota Personal Protection Act was implemented, it's become almost an equal distribution. You have, therefore, about 9 times as many permits issued in the 7-county metro as we had before, from 1,500 to something like 11,000 or 12,000 without incident. So the discrimination that occurred before has been leveled out by the Personal Protection Act, which was its primary goal, to prevent this type of blatant bias. And it was blatant bias. It wasn't sort of, it wasn't maybe. When you've got half the people getting 10% of the permits and the other half of the people getting 90% of the permits, and where most of the denials are taking place in the inner city where there are people of color, I find that rather interesting in terms of factual numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very helpful, because what I'm trying to get at is this, just theoretically. What I want to get at is whether you in particular, or the authors, and maybe Representative Cornish can elaborate on this, is it that you're against permitting in all instances, or that you're against the regime that existed, in your judgment, from 1975 to 2003, whereby, in your mind, it was discriminatory or arbitrary? Do you understand the question? Is it permitting is bad, or is it the way that permitting was done that's bad?
Mr. Kale.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we believe in proper safeguards. I find no problem with a permitting system as long as it is fair, objective, and non-discriminatory, which is why we spent 8 years crafting the wording that came into the final bill.
Thank you. That too is helpful. So I'm just trying to understand the theoretical framework here. It's not that permitting per se is bad, but in practice you objected to it. So that really kind of begs the next question, and you alluded to it at the end of your previous answer, which is what you termed the blatant discrimination. You alluded to maybe a racial element. Could you describe for the committee, and just so we make a record of it, what in your judgment, and Representative Cornish, you might be able to elaborate this based on your many years of experience too, but what in your judgment were the categories that were excluded or discriminated against? You alluded to race, but are there others as a category that you believe bore the brunt of what you see as arbitrary treatment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you look carefully, you'll see that there's a disproportionate number of women excluded. It could have run the gamut from anything like the permit or the issuing agency didn't like the way the person looked, didn't like the fact that they had long hair, all of the things that come into play when one is experiencing discrimination of any type. So the bottom line is, if you have a fair, objective set of standards, with all of the safeguards that we have added into the law to allow law enforcement to object to a permit, to issuing a permit to anyone when there is sound basis to do so and bring it into a court of law to adjudicate it, that's fine. I have no problem with that. It is the fair and impartial distribution of permits that I would like to see.
Mr. Chair. One more, Representative Simon.
One more. Thank you, Mr. Kale. I have to try to hold you to a little higher standard because this is important here, and I trust your judgment, and I know you have passion for the issue, but I think it's very important for the record when you talk about whether it's by race or whether it's by appearance, things such as long hair, is there any data on that point? And I share your frustration sometimes. You talk about, a bunch of academics at the University of Minnesota, but at some point, all kidding and joking aside, data becomes important.
Mm-hmm.
Is there data? Is there some empirical source, or is this just sort of anecdotal? Do you have studies? Do you have numbers that you think demonstrate what you described today?
Mr. Kale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you need only look at the fact that in the 7-county metro, where there were only 1,500 permits issued out of the total of approximately 12,700 issued under the old plan, to know that there's something fishy. The problem with trying to establish the reasoning, you'd have to practically interview every person who applied for a permit. Anecdotally, I can tell you I ran into an African-American woman in a gun store. I asked why she was there. Of course, that's why she was there. She had two children. She worked the afternoon shift. She came home on the bus. She had twice been assaulted on her way home and her purse taken. And when she told me that when she had applied to the Minneapolis Chief of Police for a permit, she was told the chief doesn't give out permits. That's it. So she won't appear in any statistics because they never even gave her an application. And it became well known in the metro area, forget it, this or that chief doesn't give out permits, so people simply stopped applying. And the proof of that is when the Minnesota Personal Protection Act was adopted, these people came out, they applied, they obtained permits, and we now have an almost 50-50 distribution under the new system. So I hope that answers your question as good as it's possible to know regarding the numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Kale. Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members, the short answer to that is we really don't know basically why, but to answer the question directly, in the previous law there was two requirements to get a permit. It was either a job occupational hazard or personal safety hazard. The problem is that if you came in and said you came home at 1 o'clock in the morning, you carried a bag of jewels and thousands of dollars worth of cash, even though that was proof of a job occupational hazard and a personal safety hazard, the chief or sheriff could still say no. And so that's basically how it was applied. And there was sheriffs that gave them out willy-nilly, and there were sheriffs that gave absolutely zero and halfway in between. And so that's why the law was enacted, to put a fairness and an equity in it. Now there's certain criteria and background checks and testing, and if you qualify or meet that criteria, then you get the permit. So.
All right, Joe Olson.
Mr. Chairman, we have the Scott County Sheriff next.
Sheriff Menon, if you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, fellow committee members, my name is Dave Menon from Scott County Sheriff's Office.
Go ahead.
I guess I was just open for questions. I sure can give you a couple comments. I'm definitely thought the law was a great law. I'm definitely pro-gun. There is a couple of things in this new law that I would like changed, and a couple of these are, I think, in agreement with Jim Franklin, who's our executive director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I was kind of wondering, Mr. Chairman, if I could have him just come and explain those.
Sheriff, and that would be fine, although I'm going to leave that up to the author. We kind of said you have 45 minutes for your, if you'd like that, Representative Hollis, we can do that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we will at this time.
All right, that's fine. Did you have anything else, Sheriff, or did you want to give any testimony?
I guess I was here more for questions, if anybody had any questions. The one part of the law that I think should be changed is that off-duty officers should be allowed to carry a firearm in these establishments. I think that if you want anybody out there with firearms, it's besides a good citizen, is off-duty police officers, you know, because they are trained and they can take control of a bad situation. And I think the old law kind of prohibited them from being in certain establishments or even schools with if they're off duty without their firearm.
Sure. Representative Ellison.
I hadn't intended on asking any questions until your last remark, but I got handed a newspaper article off a website that talks about a pretty tragic event. All the off-duty officers who I know handle themselves very responsibly and are helpful, but I guess here's at least one case where it didn't work out so well with an off-duty police officer, and I guess this witnesses say an off-duty cop put other people's lives at risk when he brought a handgun to the last Viking Packers game. The fallout from the story in Fox 9 investigations broke out last night. In 22 years and 75 million fans, this is the first time Metrodome management has heard of someone bringing a weapon to the game. Skipping on down the line, it says here that the Viking fan had his hands up like this. I didn't do nothing. It was really scary. He pulls out the gun, points it directly at you. It's nearly identical to an account other witnesses gave. And here it says that an off-duty cop or someone who attends an event as a fan with a ticket, there is less than zero reason to ever have a weapon at that event. According to the agency that licenses police officers, the Dome's no weapons policy even applies to law enforcement officers if they're off-duty and outside their jurisdiction. And so I guess, you know, as good as much as we appreciate our law enforcement officers doing a fine job as they do, it doesn't always work out to the advantage of the public safety. And I know at many Vikings games, there's plenty of officers who are uniform licensed and are well able to handle situations. So I just thought I'd bring that out since you brought that up.
And I agree with you. In that situation, that person should be really disciplined and shouldn't have been allowed to carry a firearm, especially if he's drinking or anything like that. There is exceptions, I'm sure.
President Corney?
Mr. Chair, members, I think Representative Howells and I agreed that we would like to keep it to no modification or amendments today, and so we wouldn't be considering that today.
Right. Okay, thank you, Chair. Joe Olson, at this point.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to reserve the rest of our time.
All right. We will move then to the opponents of the bill. Representative Stein.
I guess my general inquiry would be, since they are reserving the rest of their time, will the authors entertain some general questions now about, I don't know how it's going to work at the end.
No, we certainly can do that right now, if you two would stay up at the table.
I think that would be appropriate, then they could just call up whoever they would need as backup, if anyone.
Go ahead, Representative Simon.
Thank you. Just, there's so many aspects of this on both sides, it seems to me, that proponents or opponents could zero in on, but I'd like to zero in on just one, and that's the private property rights, particularly business rights. And I think we're going to hear some testimony about that a little bit later. I am wondering whether you've given any thought, or anyone that you're working with has given any thought, to the liability of private landowners in the following type of situation. What happens if the owner of a business fails, for whatever reason, to post the necessary sign or make the necessary verbal warning, and someone comes in and shoots up the place, and someone is injured or property is destroyed? In that hypothetical, what, if anything, would the liability of the business owner be, if you know?
Representative House.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can't answer for Representative Cornish, but I'm not an attorney. With all due respect, it sounds like a baited question. But I would ask you, does that person have a permit or not? If we're going to do scenarios.
Sure. Well, let's do it either way. Let's say the person does have a permit. And let's say someone in the establishment is injured, and that person then goes after the owner of the business saying, why the heck didn't you post a sign, or why didn't you make clear to your patrons that they weren't allowed to carry guns in? I went in looking to buy a T-shirt. Next thing I know, I'm in the hospital. I'm going after you, Mr. Business Owner. What's your understanding as to whether that's possible or not under this scenario?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would assume anything is possible. We're looking at scenarios. That scenario, to my knowledge, has not happened. You obviously work in the court system. You would probably know that if a person without a permit went into any store or into a bank and used that weapon for reasons that were not honorable, they would be in trouble and they would probably be arrested and sentenced to some sentence. Whether that criminal is liable to the owner or the owner is liable to a customer, I think then would revert to the attorneys in the courts to make that determination. It certainly is not up to me to make that determination. But I think in fairness, the owner of a business under this bill would not have to post a sign. He would have to tell someone. I don't believe, for the record, because I know you like to say for the record, that if a person were to walk into a business to buy a T-shirt with a concealed weapon, had a permit, I don't think the owner would know that he had a concealed weapon. So there would be no reason for the owner to say, please leave or take your weapon outside and lock it in your car and come back in. So I don't think we can hold the owner liable if he doesn't know, because it is a concealed weapon. Now, I can tell you one instance that happened in my county. A gentleman had a permit to carry, was shopping with his wife in a local store. And his wife was trying to get a discounted price on a scarf. And he just jokingly said, you better give us a good price because I have a concealed permit. His permit was taken from him the next day by the sheriff, because that attitude isn't accepted. So whether or not I answered your question probably made it a little more cloudy. But I think that's up to the courts to decide. And an owner of a business isn't going to know if a person has a weapon if it's concealed properly.
And Representative Simon, if you're looking for guesses as to what would happen in a case like that, I would love to take that case as a defense attorney for the business, because that seems like a tremendous stretch of liability law. But again, that's my guess is as good as yours. Do you have a follow-up?
Please.
Yep.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is less kind of a legal question than just a policy question or kind of a measure of your preferences. But why are we talking about shifting the presumption here? In other words, why should the presumption be that someone is allowed unless they're told they're not allowed? Why is that a good thing, just generally speaking?
Representative Thompson.
Why shouldn't the presumption be the opposite, in other words, for private business?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, are you talking about this posting and signing again?
Correct.
Well, I would just remind you that posting and signing was the business owners that wanted that, and during negotiations of the last bill, it was put in there for their protection, something that they wanted. And they just wanted the ability, which was in the 27-year law that preceded this, the permit to carry law, that wasn't in there. Anybody could wander in and out if they wanted to. They wanted this added protection, and we gave it to them in negotiation of the bill that allowed them to post. And like we say now it's a post or oral notice. So.
But Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. I mean, I understand that the business community did want that sign provision in there. I guess my question is, going even one step or two steps backwards from that, at sort of the initial drafting level here, why should the presumption, just as a matter of what's good to do and what's bad to do, why, whether it's a sign or oral or whatever it is, why should the presumption be, as to private businesses or private homes for that matter, why should the presumption be, unless you say something, you can, instead of the opposite, which is, unless you're told you can. Why is that, just generally speaking, why do you believe that that's a good thing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Stein, I believe it's a good thing because it would render the permit ineffective if you had every other business up and down the street, able to tell, people. What the problem it makes now is actually the business wanted it, but that the problem is made for the permit system. As you come up to one business, they have a sign, the next one you don't, and you're constantly holstering and unholstering your weapon. It would have been a better thing and probably a safer thing if the signage wasn't allowed at all, but it was put in there for their protection. And the reason it was, you know, originally crafted the law that you could do this is because it had never been a problem up until 1975. It hadn't been a problem in 27 years of the old permit law. It hadn't been a problem for business owners, but they wanted that in the negotiations that was given to them.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair, I just have a follow-up question to that point. One of the things I heard as the law had been passed was that business owners were concerned about liability. You know, I serve on the board of the Children's Museum. There's several business people on that, and they were parts of businesses that were sort of national chains. And so they said that they were getting pressure to take on additional liability insurance in Minnesota, whereas they might not need it in other states, and it was going to be costing them more money because it's kind of a gamble. You don't know if someone's going to walk in, and do you not get the insurance, or is the business owner in good conscience, do they have to go get the insurance? So are you aware, I mean, from what I've seen, that it is costing our businesses more money because they have to conform with this provision of the law. Have you seen instances of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, I haven't been contacted by any businesses claiming that they've had to pay more in liability insurance. Also, someone may come up to answer this question better than I, but the only increase that I've seen in insurance at all is since 9/11. Some insurance companies have raised their rates a little bit for terroristic threats. But other than that, I have seen no increase in insurance or had a call from any business.
Professor Olson, if you would introduce yourself and if you had thoughts to that question, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm obviously not here in that role today. I'm also president of Concealed Carry Reform Now, which is the organization that lobbied to get this law enacted. And I was present at virtually all of the negotiations that took place over the last 7 years. And I was present with the representatives from the Minnesota Business Partnership, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Small Business Group when the posting provision was worked out. They wanted the ability to post. They wanted the ability for individuals to secure their firearms in their cars rather than the stores to have to provide safe storage. And it's interesting that if you look around, Wells Fargo Bank doesn't post, U.S. Bank doesn't post, Walmart doesn't post, Target doesn't post, Cub doesn't post, Wendy's doesn't post, McDonald's doesn't post, Kentucky Fried Chicken doesn't post. I live in Roseville, and there is only one business in Roseville that has a sign. So essentially what we have done is we've set up a situation where the property owner who wants to post their property can do so. The vast majority of them don't. There are relatively few signs. They are clearly placed so that the permit holder can see them. And it's my understanding that they are respected by the citizens and there are really no problems. There's certainly none that have been reported to me. So we have a system that allows the owner of private property to choose. And we have a system that makes expressing the choice clear and easy to do. And it's a system that is very similar to what is in place in a number of other states, all of which have had the same kind of good experience that we've had in Minnesota.
Representative Dean, and then I think we will move on to the opponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Olson,
Just relating to Representative Slawik's comments, are you aware that Minnesota has experienced any higher or lower insurance rates with your experience with the business community as a result of this legislation?
I'm not personally aware because I don't buy insurance for business, but I have heard from business people that I've talked to that there is no difference in insurance. There's no difference in insurance in Texas or in Florida or in North Carolina or in any other state that has these kinds of laws.
Mr. Chair and Professor Olson, are you aware of any differences in insurance costs in Minnesota between those businesses that posted signs and those businesses that did not post signs?
I'm not aware of any, and I will speculate a bit that the people who come into any place, whether it's a place of public accommodation or anywhere else, to cause trouble, have already made criminal decisions, are unlikely to be influenced by the law against armed robbery or the law against carrying a firearm. And so that risk is there irrespective of the sign. I'm not aware of any instance where a sign was given credit for preventing a crime.
All right. Thank you, Professor Wilson. And I believe you still have a few minutes to reserve. 9 minutes. All right. Let's move to the opponents of the bill. And the first person on my list is Superintendent Dan Taylor. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. All right. Superintendent, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. I am Dan Taylor, Superintendent of Schools in the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School District. I'm also a member of the board of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. In our school district, as is the case with every school district of which I am aware, needs the authority to ban guns and all weapons from school grounds, school parking lots, school buildings, and school campuses. It is important for our locally elected school boards working with their communities to have the authority to ban firearms from all school property, including parking lots and unimproved grounds. Those of us who have witnessed heated arguments between parents of students, or between students, those of us who have observed irate parents, sometimes a custodial parent, disagreeing with a non-custodial parent, or irate parents in bleachers, we certainly do not want guns, firearms, or any type of weapon to be readily accessible. And believe me, in my 35 years in education, I have observed many situations where the exchange between individuals could well have escalated to the point where emotions would overtake all sense of reason, and I would not have wanted firearms, guns, or weapons easily accessible to these citizens. We all know that guns and other weapons can and have fallen into wrong hands. To allow guns to be in trunks of cars, even if out of sight, in a school parking lot is wrong. The danger is there for that weapon to fall into the wrong hands. And I would encourage that we either ban firearms or alter, either ban firearms from our school, or at least give locally elected school boards the complete authority to ban guns from school premises. Anything less than that presents a danger to our schools, our students, and staff, and is not in anyone's best interest. And we can look to other states that have concealed carry statutes. And some of these states, they either prohibit guns from school grounds or allow local governments to do so. Just a few examples. Montana allows local government units to regulate the discharge of firearms. It may prevent the carrying of firearms to a public assembly, publicly owned buildings, parks, and schools. Arkansas prohibits permit holders from taking a gun onto school grounds. Arkansas also allows any person or entity exercising control over the physical location of a place to prohibit the carrying of a concealed weapon by placement of a sign. Texas is another example, prohibits permit holders from carrying guns on school grounds or to school events. And still another, Oklahoma, prohibits persons having a concealed handgun license from carrying a concealed handgun into an elementary, secondary, or vocational technical school property, including parking lots. And with that, I just would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, and would encourage you to consider these changes.
Thank you, Superintendent Taylor. I have a question. I think Representative Emmer does too. Because this issue, when we were debating this bill 2 years ago, it came up a lot. I had a lot of parents in the school districts that I represent call up and talk about guns in schools. And I always found it frustrating because this bill is actually stricter with respect to a prohibition of guns in schools than what we had before and what we will have if we don't repass this bill. Under the old law and what is now the current law, after the bill was found unconstitutional, a permit holder can carry his or her handgun into a school, and there's nothing you can do about it. Under the Personal Protection Act, that is now a crime. So I guess I'm a little confused as to why this would be worse when it's actually better from a school standpoint.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm stating simply that we need to have guns banned entirely from schools. That would be either on the school in the school building, the school campus, the school parking lot, or concealed in trunks of cars. And that is the definite position of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts as well.
Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you did hit the one thing that I wanted to ask the superintendent, but I have another thing. I find that a lot of people's fear about guns comes from lacking knowledge about guns and how to use them and about the safety concerns. Superintendent, do you personally own a gun?
I personally own about 16 guns. I am a lifetime member of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I own a tree farm. I grouse hunt. I'm an avid outdoors person. In my 35 years in education, I've often spent immediately after school on a weekend, Friday night, leave for my tree farm for hunting activity. But I have never concealed a weapon in the trunk of my car for fear that it could fall in the wrong hands. I own guns. I treat them very respectfully.
Right.
And I just don't want guns to appear in schools, in school parking lots, or in the proximity of schools, because that danger is there for them to fall into wrong hands.
Mr. Chairman, Superintendent, I do appreciate that, because the point that you just made is that you're not against the safe use of guns. The question that I have relates to the fact that you gave testimony about custodial and non-custodial parents under the law, which is more strict than the law that previously existed. I don't know of any permitted gun owners, holders, that actually use those guns within the last couple of years in the type of situation that you're referring to. And I would ask you to reconsider your position about schools, because I, for one, went to a high school where we not only had guns on the premises, we were taught how to use them. We actually had gun training, range training, and based on your statements, they wouldn't be allowed to do that anymore. So I would ask that you at least give some thought to the other side of the issue, that there are schools out there that actually teach folks, young people, about gun safety and how to properly use guns. And I would just submit to you that your position is not necessarily universal. There are schools out there that are actually, they have guns on the premises as part of their teaching.
Superintendent Taylor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm also the former superintendent of Grand Rapids School District. And there, in fact, there was gun safety taught in the schools. Given the set of circumstances that we face today, the amount of violence that we see, having had it to do over again, I would ask that gun safety take place other than directly at the school site. Not that school personnel would necessarily have to not be involved or excluded. I think they could be teachers of firearms, but it would be most important, in my view, that the gun safety take place at a site other than a school building, and that firearms would be permitted or prohibited from that site.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative, one
thank you, and very briefly, so I can make it clear, Superintendent, I'm not just talking about gun safety. We had a gun range in the school, and we had 22 rifles that we were taught not only how to use in a safe manner, but how to take care of and how to clean. And based on your testimony, that would never be allowed. And I think in this day and age, more than at any other time in our history, it's very important that we not ignore the realities that are going on around us, and that people be educated in on this issue as young as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Taylor.
Thank you.
The next person on our list is James Hublin. Welcome to the committee, Mayor. If you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
My name is Jim Hubland, H-O-V-L-A-N-D. I'm the new mayor of Edina, and I am appearing today at your hearing, Mr. Chair, on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. I have been asked by the League to come and comment on the bill relative to its effect on cities. It's actually an issue that was partially discussed back in 2003. The superintendent just raised the issue in a somewhat oblique manner to what we're concerned about. We know that from the 03 bill, guns are not permitted in schools, or they can post it up for schools, but we still face the dilemma with respect to publicly owned facilities, parks, and city buildings where we have no ability to post them up. And we'd like, the League is requesting an amendment to the Citizens Personal Protection Act that would allow cities to prohibit handguns in city-owned buildings, facilities, and parks. The League itself is not seeking to repeal the Personal Protection Act, nor authority to prohibit legal weapons in parking lots or on city streets or sidewalks, but they would like the ability to be able to post up city-owned buildings, facilities, and parks. So that's the League position. As for the city of Edina, I can tell you that in 2003, the city of Edina City Council passed a resolution opposing the Citizens Personal Protection Act. The position of our city remains the same on that. I think Teddy Roosevelt said 9/10 of wisdom is being wise in time. We think to be wise in time, it would be appropriate not to to reenact the Citizens Protection Act from our city's standpoint. We like the old rules. We'd like to have our chief have the ability to make those decisions on a discriminatory basis as to who or who should not be allowed to carry a handgun, have a permit. So that's our personal city position. The League's position is slightly different. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. Next person on the list is Steve Borchert. And Harlan Johnson as well. Gentlemen, whoever would like to go first, just please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I will. My name is Steve Borchert. I'm the Sheriff of Olmsted County. And I appear before you today on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And I guess we're not probably speaking in opposition to reenactment of the Minnesota Personal Protection Act, as it's become known. We're probably speaking on this side of the agenda by virtue of the fact that we understand that the authors didn't want to entertain amendments, and we think that the act can be improved. We worked closely with the members of CRN and the authors prior to 2003. We were able to influence them to make some changes that we thought were positive to the bill. Not all the changes that we would have liked to see, but when it passed, we threw ourselves into it with good faith and enthusiasm. There may be an occasional sheriff out there who is philosophically opposed, but on balance,
I think everybody would acknowledge that with the short time frame that we had to implement this, something less than 3 months, we put together application processes, we put together a card. In fact, my secretary designed a card that became used statewide because there was no provision or resources provided in the bill to accomplish that, and we only had something less than, I believe, 3 months, if my memory serves me well, to put it together. So we put it together basically on a volunteer basis, and we created the workflow systems, we created the record systems, we created the employees necessary to implement that in very short order. And I think, frankly, it went quite smoothly. We have now a couple years of experience with this, and we know that for all the fears that lots of folks had before it passed, ourselves included, the fact is the sky didn't fall. And the fact is that it's worked pretty seamlessly. So we're not here to stand in opposition of reenacting the bill, but there are some common sense changes and improvements that could be made to this bill. And if you indulge me for just a second, I'd like to mention a few of them. Number one, Minnesota residents. Currently, under the current form of the MPPA, out-of-state residents can apply to the sheriff of their choice in order to get a permit in Minnesota. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, particularly with the prohibitions on what we can ask on the application to aid our background investigation. It just seems a little silly that somebody can come here from Wisconsin or who knows where and tell us virtually nothing about the past and then be granted a permit from Olmsted County, Minnesota. We'd like to see that limited. Fee reporting, the fee and reporting. There's a fear that there would be profits made by sheriffs on the processing if they charged $100 for the fee. And so there's a reporting, an annual reporting requirement. We have to submit a P&L statement, if you will, showing that we didn't make any money. And yet there's still a $100 cap. Sheriffs from Hennepin and Ramsey County have advised me with the population that they have and the workload this has brought about, $100 isn't addressing their needs. It would seem to me that if we have to file annual P&L statements to prove that we're not making a profit, there's no need for a cap. Training programs, there's currently no quality control on the training programs. Now, we, in a hurried fashion, put together a system where trainers could voluntarily submit their curriculum to us. And, or to, frankly, it was then superintendent of the PCA, Mike Campion. They would look at the curriculum and establish that it did meet the curriculum components as required by the statute. But beyond that, there is no authority for quality control. And what has happened in other states is unscrupulous folks who do have training credentials have issued certificates of completion without the candidate actually attending the class. They've virtually just been selling them. And that potential exists under the current form of the MPPA here. We think that could be tightened up. Background investigations, we're prohibited from asking anything. There's simply a statement on the application that asks the applicant if they are aware that they may be prohibited from having a permit. It doesn't go into any detail. And we think there are some questions that are appropriate, having to do with a proven history of chemical dependency, having to do with a proven history of mental illness, having to do with various other things that are really, in a common sense, very pertinent to whether or not somebody should have a gun on them. Secondly, we're prohibited from asking which city or county they resided in another state. We can ask which state they resided in, which will allow us to query the computerized criminal history of that state, but that's all we get. And if whatever behaviors they engaged in that could be risky didn't rise to the level of something that ended up in a criminal history bank at the state level, we'd never find out about it. It would be nice to be able to call a local sheriff and say, do you know this person? It just seems relatively common sense. And we side with the previous speaker relative to municipal and government buildings. There are many kinds of meetings that, as you're aware, can be quite contentious. And it's just not a good idea to have guns there. So for local government to be able to restrict their own venues, we think is appropriate. And last but not least, there's a little subtle part of the previous MPPOA that a lot of people aren't even aware of. But when venues are posted so that permitted carriers cannot carry a gun on the premises, that applies also to off-duty police officers. There was is an effort to equate permitted carriers with off-duty police officers relative to qualifications and professional abilities. And we think that's frankly ludicrous. Somebody who is certainly qualified to carry under a permit because they took a class doesn't come anywhere close to a licensed professional police officer who qualifies with that weapon several times a year and who is on a daily basis engaged in use of force issues and is trained to make those kinds of decisions. And in fact, the way the MPPA is written now, a law enforcement officer off duty driving home from work, driving past the school grounds, observes a shooting on the school grounds, can't enter those school grounds with their gun on to address that issue without violating the MPPA. I just don't think that's good public policy. I don't think it was the intent of most of the legislators when they voted for that bill. It's a very simple fix. Now, earlier, Representative Ellenson, I heard you make reference to a very unfortunate occurrence, and you're absolutely right, and there's no defense for it. And off-duty cops aren't going to be perfect, just as on-duty cops aren't going to be perfect. However, on balance, in this time, I think it is counterproductive to public safety to tell off-duty peace officers that they can't be armed and able to conduct the function of their professional ability when in a deadly force situation simply because they're off-duty. They aren't the same as a permitted citizen. Plain and simple. So those are our issues. We'd like to see some of those addressed and fixed, and frankly, we think it'll be a stronger law. We do not stand in opposition to the notion of law-abiding, properly trained citizens from being able to carry a handgun to protect themselves. But we think this will be a stronger law with some of these changes. Thank you.
Mr. Sheriff, you're probably right. I mean, I'm sure that this does not reflect most off-duty officers. I only offer to say, you know, there's some people say there's no problems. There have been problems, and it's better to acknowledge the problem than to deny the problem. But I think you're probably right that there probably should be an adjustment if we're going to have this thing. It probably should reflect what you say. My question is a little different, though. I got an email here that says total cost to Hennepin County were about $676,000, but only $676,000 was the cost. $400,000 was collected, resulting in a loss of about $200,000 in Hennepin County. We're not dealing with amendments today, but what would your proposal be? To simply not have a cap, let the Sheriff's Department charge their own fee? Can you share your views on that?
Sheriff Porter.
Chair Johnson, Representative Ellison, yes, you hit it on the head. There's no need for a cap, provided that we are subjected to this annual reporting system that requires that we cannot make a profit. Let it float as needed on a county-by-county basis, and we'll submit the appropriate reporting.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Representative Cornish, how do you feel about that?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm against any increase in the fee. Fact is now that there's a lot of sheriffs that don't spend that much and that there's some that spend over that. The ones that spend over that have to take a close look at their budget and see what they're spending on. We found some instances where they're spending on things that they shouldn't be. And it's up, the reason we need a cap is if you don't have a cap, it's a form of discrimination because you can charge any amount you want. And if you say that, well, yeah, they can charge more, but they have to justify it. Well, then it goes into interpretation. Are you going to charge because this person handled the paperwork, that person handled the paperwork? Are you going to pay for salaries, fringe, computer software? You know, what are you going to pay for? So we would like to see the way originally intended, let this thing cook a few years and get a better tracking system to see what they're spending their money on before we increase the fee. Because there's some that charge hardly anything and some that charge over.
Tim House, do you have something?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to make a note that when this bill was being negotiated and the sheriffs were at the table, Dick Cook, the sheriff from Rice County, stated that $40 net to the sheriff was adequate.
Mr. Johnson, did you have testimony as well?
Mr. Chair, my name is Carlin Johnson. I executive director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, representing over 300 police chiefs. And basically, I'm here to reiterate what the sheriff has said. We came with a simple request to recognize off-duty officers and their ability to thwart crime, even when they're off-duty and outside their jurisdiction. We also support Mayor Marie Dino in his position of being able to ban guns on their property if they choose to do so, and same with county property.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Penny Sinner?
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Slavik. Mr. Chair, if we don't get through our testifiers, there's some concern about they were actually in support of the bill as opposed to being against the bill and being counted against our time and so forth. So hopefully we'll get through our testifiers.
Hopefully we'll get through the testimony and then we won't have to deal with it.
Okay.
But
thank
let's
you.
Make that our goal.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Sinner. If you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Penny Sinner. I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health and an intern for Citizens for a Safer Minnesota. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the committee. I would like to summarize briefly the science behind firearm injury prevention and what public health research tells us about the consequences of concealed carry laws. For more than a decade, shall-issue concealed carry laws have been implemented in over 33 states. The reason for passing concealed carry is usually based on the theory that more armed, law-abiding citizens in a community will deter crime. But as the theory has been tested over time, research shows that carrying concealed weapons has little, if any, impact on crime rates. Research from the University of Chicago, Yale, Stanford, and Harvard all report that shall-issue laws have not had any significant effect on crime rates. The National Academy of Science report concluded there is no evidence that shall-issue laws reduce crime. In some instances, researchers have found a small but statistically insignificant increase in gun violence and homicide in larger cities after shall-issue laws have passed. Research into Americans' attitudes and beliefs about carrying concealed weapons has consistently resulted in majorities opposed to the practice. Two national telephone surveys conducted in 1996 and 1999 by the National Opinion Research Council found that Americans in a ratio of 5-1 feel less safe rather than more safe as more people in their communities carry guns. Also, Americans by a ratio of 9-1 do not believe that regular citizens should be allowed to carry their firearms into restaurants, college campuses, sports stadiums, bars, hospitals, or government buildings. A University of Minnesota state survey question modeled after the one done by the National Council demonstrated that the majority of Minnesotans believe that only individuals with a special need, such as a security guard, should be able to obtain a permit to carry a loaded handgun in public. That the practice should not be extended to all adults who complete a background check and safety training. This majority includes majorities of males, females, urban and rural dwellers, and all political party affiliations. In 2003, shortly after the shall-issue concealed carry law was passed, the Star Tribune conducted a survey and found that 55% of Minnesotans said that the law makes Minnesota less safe, while only 17% responded that it would make Minnesota safer. While research showed little association between shall-issue laws and crime, there is a growing body of evidence that the prevalence and accessibility of firearms has an impact on the rate of firearm-related death and injury. For example, research from Johns Hopkins and Harvard has shown that states with higher gun prevalence have higher firearm injury and death rates in all age groups than most states with low gun prevalence. Children living in high gun prevalence states are 16 times as likely to die from unintentional firearm injury, 7 times more likely to die from firearm suicide, and 3 times more likely to die from firearm homicide than children in low gun prevalence states. We also know that the risk of unintentional firearm injury, suicide, and homicide increases when guns are available in the home. Studies from the New England Journal of Medicine and the American Journal of Public Health found that the risk of homicide doubles with guns in the home. Another study published in the Journal of Trauma shows that a gun in the home is 22 times more likely to be used against a family member than an intruder. The chart that I handed out to you guys demonstrates this concept visually. Firearm death rates from 2002 have been ranked by the Center for Disease Controls. Superimposed on the chart is a color code indicating the status of concealed carry laws, which most often coincides with the status of gun laws generally in that state. you can see that states with more gun deaths tend to be those with looser firearm laws and greater gun prevalence. Physicians, public health professionals, and safety experts agree the best way to prevent all manner of gun death and injury is to keep firearms securely stored. Concealed carry laws that allow more access to handguns in the community are counterintuitive to what we know about gun safety. Thank you again for the opportunity to present this information and for considering the long-term public health ramifications of firearm policies.
Thank you, Ms. Center. The next person on our list is Kate Havlin. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Havlin.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm Kate Havlin, chapter president of the Twin Cities Million Mom March. As a million mom, a group concerned with safe kids and sensible gun laws, and as the mother of two elementary school boys, I'd like to talk about the message concealed carry sends to our kids. By passing concealed carry and making it ridiculously easy for almost any adult Minnesotan to carry a gun in public, we are sending a dangerous message to our kids. We adults are saying, we believe that more guns are the way to solve our problems. I do not want my sons, their friends, classmates, or any kids to get that message from this legislature. Recently, our state and country have seen terrible tragedies of people who turn to guns to solve their problems. I do not know why any person, regardless of age, would choose to bring a gun somewhere, a school, workplace, restaurant, or courthouse, and shoot people. But I do know that all of us are at risk when it is so easy for so many people to have guns in so many public places. After the Red Lake shooting, some suggested the answer was to arm teachers and principals. More guns are not the answer. Living in a heavily armed society will not teach our children to work out problems peacefully. If we want to live in a safer society, we need to learn to solve problems without resorting to guns and violence. Our kids will not get that message if we continue to pass laws like concealed carry. In the short time that the 2003 concealed carry law was in effect, some 25,000 gun permits were issued. That means there could be 25,000 more Minnesotans carrying guns in workplaces, stores, restaurants, and parks. There were more permits, but those permits were balanced by the signs that my family and I saw frequently. At the community center, the grocery store, the doctor's office, the vets, the coffee shop, the gym, and so many other places, we saw signs that banned guns on the premises. Those shops and businesses were taking a stand against being part of an armed society. They said that more guns were not the answer. And that is the message that I want my sons and all young people to see and learn. If we continue to act as if guns are the answer, so will our kids. We can do better to protect our kids and to ensure that all of us can live in a safer community. Thank you.
Thank you. Carol Arthur is the next name on the list.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Carol Arthur. I'm the executive director of the Domestic Abuse Project in Minneapolis. Founded in 1979, our agency was the first domestic violence therapy program in Minnesota. We also have a criminal justice intervention project with legal advocates that work with all victims of domestic assault contacts in the city of Minneapolis. Each year we see more than 8,000 men, women, and children at our agency. am here to speak against this bill that would put more guns in our homes. Domestic violence and guns are a deadly combination. In the past 5 years in the state of Minnesota, 113 women have been murdered as a result of domestic violence, 48% of them with guns. During that same period of time, 8% of the children murdered in domestic violence and 36% of the family members or friends that attempted to intervene were killed with guns. Personal Protection Act would tend to tell us that battered women ought to arm themselves against their abusers, whether they still live with abusive parties or have left them. Studies indicate to us, one reported in 2003 in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, indicated that while two-thirds of women who owned guns acquired them primarily for protection against crime, the results of this California analysis showed that purchasing a handgun provided no protection against homicide among women and, in fact, was associated with an increase in their risk for intimate partner homicide. Another June 2003 study about the risks of firearms in the home found that females living with a gun in the home were nearly three times more likely to be murdered than females with no gun in the home. Another study reports women who were murdered were more likely, not less likely, to have purchased a handgun in the 3 years prior to their deaths, again invalidating the idea that a handgun has a protective effect against homicide. The last study I want to share with you is a 2002 study from researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health. It found that although the U.S. represented 32% of the female population among 25 high-income countries in the world, it accounted for 84% of all female firearm homicides. The study's lead author, Dr. David Hemenway, concluded that the differences in female homicide victimization rates between the United States and these other industrialized nations is very large and is closely tied to levels of gun ownership. The relationship cannot be explained by differences in urbanization or income inequality. Finally, I have to share with you testimony that I gave in 2003 when this bill was first introduced. I gave it on behalf of a battered woman who was too fearful to come in front of the committee because it was a televised hearing, and she couldn't risk having her abuser know she was back in the state of Minnesota. She was living in fear of an abuser that she had left several years previously. During her marriage, her abuser had assaulted her on numerous occasions, frequently with a weapon. Like many battered women, she was too fearful of him to participate in the prosecution of those domestic assault arrests. He was never convicted. He would have qualified to get a conceal and carry permit, although he had been arrested many times. After she left the marriage and was seeking a divorce, he threatened many times to shoot her down in the street. There was nothing that would stop him. She also talks about that had she had the opportunity to arm herself during that time that she lived with her ex-husband, one of two things would have happened. She believed either she would have shot him to death in his sleep to be free of the fear of being assaulted, or he would have taken the weapon away from her and used it against her. She wondered if she was supposed to use a weapon to protect herself. Should she be armed and ready at all times? Should she carry a loaded gun with the safety off while she brings her children to school, to the grocery store, on her way to work, at work, going out the door in the morning? Must she be prepared to kill every minute of the day? A firearm only increases the potential for violence. Experts in the field of domestic violence would never recommend that a woman arm herself for protection. We believe that guns only increase the risk of domestic violence resulting in fatalities. Thank you for this opportunity to testify once again and talk about my opposition to this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Arthur. John Arms is the next person on the list, and then I have Lee Lynch as the last testifier. Is Mr. Arms here?
Oh.
Is
one person's name is on the
Mr. Chair, there was one person that was left off the list inadvertently.
So John Arms is not testifying? Okay. Mr. Lynch?
Good morning. I'm Lee Lynch. I'm the founder of Carmichael Lynch, an advertising agency. Works for clients like Rapala Lures and Harley-Davidson for over 25 years. Thanks for buying them. I'm involved in the La Meridian Hotel, downtown Minneapolis, a new hotel. It was voted one of the top 100 hotels in America, in the world, I should say. And I'm chairman of the Historic Theater Group, which manages the State, the Orpheum, and the Pantages Theaters. Altogether, maybe about 700 employees, but thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, many from outside the state of Minnesota, in fact, outside this nation, are coming to our various facilities. Now, I don't like what's going on here. As a business person, I'm being put between a rock and a hard place and a hard place. The rock is the sign, which a noted Toronto designer came to town and said, whoever did that was a visual sadist. I don't like that because it creates, when the sign is up, a perception of chaos. You know, like, what's going on here? This is for the people that come from other places. Like, what's going on here? You know, what is our problem? Is there violence going on? Should I arm myself? Should I even come here? That's the rock. The hard place is the verbal notification. Do we do it before the start of the Lion King, of having them say, drop your weapons? How is this going to work? Or do we have the concierge at the hotel, you know, try to check people from Tokyo and tell them that they can't have a weapon? I'm a gun owner, by the way. I'm not crazy about this whole issue as much as I am as a business person. Because the third hard place is this murky liabilis exposure to a lawsuit. Now, we're not posting at two of our places. We're not posting at Carmichael Lynch, and we're not posting at the La Meridian Hotel. And we're probably doing like a lot of other business people are saying, is that let's hope it happens to somebody else and not us, that they're going to have the litigation and the law, the lawyer's fees to pay. Because the incidents of something happening are probably, you know, the math would say it'd be four times bigger. We've got four times more people out there with a concealed weapon, four times more opportunity for an incident. Maybe there will never be an incident. Let's hope there won't be. But we're sitting around saying, I hope it doesn't happen to us because we've chosen not to post and that could be used against us. Our counsel says that we have a liability. So a rock and a hard place and a hard place is not where I like to be. I didn't mind the other way of doing it, and I sure think when I hear the discrimination things, I wish they could fix the discrimination as they have in housing discrimination and other things, if that's a problem, and who gets a permit or not. I wish they'd fix that, but go back to the sheriff or whoever, the law enforcement people, granting the permits, rather than putting me in the business of sort of deciding whether I'm going to be the screener or not. So that's it. I thank you very much for letting me come.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Mr. Arms? No. Okay, Pastor Strand, and we have, I believe, 3 minutes left, but Representative Slawick pointed out that two of the contestifiers actually supported the bill, even though they didn't speak in favor of it. They requested change, so I'm going to give you an extra few minutes, hopefully not 2 minutes.
Okay.
Please come forward. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record, sir.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Pastor Eric Strand. I'm co-pastor at Edina Community Lutheran Church in Edina, Minnesota, known as ECLC. I've been there for 16 years. ECLC is a congregation of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. We are a Christian community of faith who seek to give witness to Jesus Christ in our worship and daily life. And as such, even our Constitution includes a commitment to peacemaking and nonviolence in all relationships. As part of that commitment, it has been understood that weapons are not consistent with our witness of faith. Upon passage of the so-called concealed carry law, ECLC made this understanding a formal policy. And so it is that we notify those entering our religious property of the prohibition of firearms by posting signs using in part the words of Jesus, "Blessed are the peacemakers, firearms are prohibited in this place of sanctuary."
We took this action prayerfully, fully understanding that we were not complying with the specific and, we believe, unconstitutional requirements of the Personal Protection Act. When the law went into effect, ECLC was the first religious institution to challenge its constitutionality. We were quickly joined by the Episcopal Diocese of Minnesota and thereafter by many Lutheran, Jewish, Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian, Buddhist, Congregational, UCC, and Baptist communities of faith. Our decision to resort to the courts was supported by our bishop, and we have also appreciated the support of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese, whose six cathedral churches have joined a lawsuit in Ramsey County. With the exception of those who have dumped spent shell casings on our steps to intimidate us, we have received overwhelming support not only from other faith communities, but also from our fellow citizens in Edina. In response to our lawsuit, the Hennepin County District Court determined that the signage and personal notification provisions of the law violated the religious freedom guarantee of the Minnesota Constitution and that we would suffer irreparable injury from being forced to comply with these requirements. The court entered a temporary injunction, and after a favorable decision by the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the district court determined that the parking lot and landlord tenant provisions of the law also violated the Minnesota Constitution, and they broadened the injunction. The injunction remains in place pending the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision whether to review the Ramsey County Court decision, now affirmed by the Court of Appeals that the bill of which concealed carry was a part, violated the single subject provision of the Minnesota Constitution. And while that is a secular issue, the Ramsey County Court also observed that the concealed carry law appears to violate the Constitution's guarantee of religious freedom. And so with so many religious institutions of so many faiths expressing concern, and with three judicial opinions highlighting the concealed carry bill's infringement on religious freedom, you can only imagine our congregation's surprise to see that the authors of House File 2428 seem not to have listened to religious institutions and the courts. Despite the findings of court after court, the new bill makes only a single change to the old unconstitutional law, changing and to or. House File 2428 contains no provision recognizing the right of religious institutions to prohibit firearms on all of their religious property. It is our witness and clear testimony at ECLC as people of faith in Jesus Christ that allowing private citizens to carry firearms on our property is contrary to the way of life to which God calls us. As many of you know, the front door of a Lutheran church has a special place in our denomination's history. However, this bill would mandate not religious theses, but secular verbiage. In order to prohibit firearms from our church building with a sign, we would have to post words at our front door chosen by the state, words without a religious message. If we choose not to post a sign, we would first have to personally notify a gun carrier and then issue an order to leave. If that order is not obeyed, the only penalty would be a $25 fine, a petty misdemeanor, which is not even a crime. We do not understand why the authors of the bill want to decriminalize the law of trespass, and even more so, we do not understand why the authors of this bill seek to sanction state interference with our religious faith and practice. This bill would also eliminate our right as a landlord to insist on a weapons-free facility, even in our Sunday school rooms used by a licensed nursery school. And this bill would completely prevent us from prohibiting firearms in our parking lot, even as we sometimes use it as a place of worship. Some of you, or some of your religious institutions, may have differing views regarding the presence of firearms in a place of worship. We respect your right under the Minnesota Constitution to worship as you see fit. It is precisely for that reason that House File 2428 is so offensive to our congregation. We and other religious institutions hope you will respect our right to control our religious property so that we may worship without firearms or such egregious interference by the state. As we at Edina Community Lutheran celebrate the resurrection in this Easter season, we believe we are called to give a witness to a culture of life that is mindful of the needs of the poor and stands in testimony against the many ways of violence in our world. Such is our witness and testimony to you on this day. There is no reason for the state to compel us to welcome guns onto our property or into our religious activities, and there is no reason for the state to script our speech and witness with language that is not consistent with our religious beliefs. Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor Strand. All right, we have one testifier left. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and if you could keep your comments brief, you are over your time, but I'm going to go ahead and let you talk in.
My name is Mary Lewis Grow, G-R-O-W. I live in Northfield, and I'm here to read a letter to the committee from former Governor Arne Carlson, who could not be here. I also call to the attention of the committee Pioneer Press editorial that was published yesterday by former Representative Janet Clark Enzel. She was also Assistant Commissioner of Corrections. Governor Carlson's letter. It is with a true sense of sadness that I write this letter relative to House File 2428. This sadness emanates from what is becoming a growing perception that Minnesota is moving away from its traditional standards regarding quality of life. This bill is just another instance of where a narrow interest will be allowed to prevail over the general good of the populace. Traditionally, our lawmakers understood the value of being able to balance local concerns with legitimate state interests. In this particular instance, years of division were resolved by enhancing the powers of local government, thereby recognizing that attitudes towards weapons in Coochiching County may well be significantly different than attitudes that prevail in Hennepin. Local government was seen as that unit of government most able to be responsive to local attitudes. Local standards were respected. Under the proposed legislation, the state will completely usurp the powers of local government and significantly expand the right of trespass with concealed weapon. This seizing of power by the state is completely contrary to traditional conservative values. Further, the argument for this legislation does not rest upon the normal premise that public policy changes should come about only in order to improve our quality of life. Rather, the strongest argument proponents make is that this change in law will not be as harmful as the critics declare. That hardly constitutes a standard of excellence. But what is particularly onerous is that the legislature exempts itself and the officers of the state from the very provisions of this bill that they declare will benefit the citizenry. This policy of exemption is comparable to one in which the captain takes the first lifeboat off a sinking ship. Not only does this exemption suggest a lack of confidence in this new policy, but it will also subject lawmakers to endless criticisms of hypocrisy. Citizens will inevitably raise questions such as, does the legislature actually intend to suggest that this policy would in fact create a more dangerous situation, and they therefore would like to be exempt, or are they suggesting that their lives have greater value than the lives of the citizens they serve? I have it in the lives of the citizens they serve. I have a suspicion that if this bill were a tax reduction proposal, the legislature would have an army of attorneys making absolutely certain that every reduction provision applied to them. This is truly a flawed piece of public policy. I need not comment on the flood of signs that will become a permanent part of our daily life, nor do I need to remind you that the bill raises enormous confusion relative to how a property owner can adequately protect his rights against trespass. I trust that the committee will at least build some clarity into this new policy. It would be my hope that the legislature will rethink this issue and truly allow local government to continue to play a lead role in this area. This balance is necessary in order to allow community standards to prevail. I wish you the very best. Warmest regards, Arne Carlson. And in my own voice, I just would like to remind the committee that last November, there were 13 legislative seats that changed hands. 11 of those who were defeated were proponents of the concealed carry law. I think that this law exemplifies the kind of extremism that voters rejected at the polls last November. And I would also ask every member of the committee to remember that your vote is going to be a very, very clear statement of whether you support the public's interests or the special interests.
Thank you. Representative House, did you care to use your 9 minutes or not?
At this point, Mr. Chairman, I think we can debate the bill we'll use up the 9 minutes in some fashion during that debate.
All right. Well, what my intent, if you're not going to use it separately, is we're going to vote in 45 minutes. So we will move into debate for the bill then. And that will put us at, what, 20 after? We'll be done at 20 after. 19 after. Discussion to the bill. Any discussion? Representative Slawa.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I suppose I need to wait till we're going to vote, but I want to make sure I request a roll call when it is time to vote.
Roll call. All right. We'll have a roll call.
Thank you. You know, Mr. Chair, it's and members, in a way, it's hard to believe we're sitting here today. We thought this debate was over. We thought this issue was done. We thought it was put to bed. And then, as we know, the courts, the issue was taken to court primarily because of the technicality, because of the second subject rule. And then we know it was ruled unconstitutional. But how quickly it came back. It hasn't even been taken to the Supreme Court yet. Yet we're putting this bill through, despite the fact that legislative deadlines are done. Most of the bills around here have died by now because they either had to make their policy deadlines or their finance deadlines, yet we're sitting here today resurrecting the bill and pushing it through. You know, in my mind, it's been an interesting debate. It's hard for me to get motivated this year. I think it's kind of a rough year at the legislature. You know, we're doing our G words. We've done our gambling last week, and we've done our God stuff and gay marriage, and now we're doing guns. And it seems for us it's kind of one battle after the next. And for me, it's, you know, I worry about Minnesota, and I worry about what we're doing to the soul of our state. Are we selling it through gambling? Are we selling it out through guns? It seems like when I'm often on the losing end of these battles, and I know that, and I know that's where I stand, but I know that the people that testified here today and that don't believe in this bill have really genuine concerns about having more guns in our society. You know, we're okay with hunting. We're okay with people that need guns for protection reasons or for job reasons. But this bill, as it stands, has a lot of problems. We know that. We heard from a mayor of a city. We heard from Lee Lynch, who's a business guy. We heard from a superintendent of a school and from pastor about all the problems that this law has caused at their workplaces, that's causing at their religious institutions. We heard about the signs, and I know there's an and or an or, and the and has been changed to the or, but it's still not good having these signs up, even if they have a choice of whether to put them up. And they are around. You know, they're at Lifetime, where I work out. They're at the Children's Museum. They are all over the place. They're at Emation, which is I have $3 billion companies in my district. I have 3M, Emation, and Kodak. The new president of Emation, who moved here from back east, said that was the most startling thing to him of moving to Minnesota. Wasn't even the winter. It was the signs, the gun signs. And how could Minnesotans tolerate having those signs up? And what is the state doing in terms of gun safety and gun issues? I think there's three things that are clear. One, there's a lot of problems with this bill, and I would urge the authors to think about making some changes in it. Issues with the signs, obviously. Issues with religious institutions, counties, universities. If there was a way where they could be guaranteed that folks couldn't carry in those places. I know you don't want to make any changes, but there's a lot of very rational, reasonable people that think you should at least think about that. I think the second thing that's clear is you have the votes, that this is going to pass the committee, and it's going to pass the House, and it's going to pass the Senate, and the governor's going to sign it. I mean, I don't think that's unclear here today. We know the position we're in. It's clear that NRA's been in the state, and they're back, and Representative Cornish talked about that. But that's still unfortunate, I think. And it's clear that for the third thing, that guns don't make us safer. I mean, I just think of Red Lake and I think of Representative Emmer's example of 22 rifles being on a school ground for a shooting for gun safety, but about kids. And we know that this is happening all over the country, that our kids have issues. We know that. But they seem to be finding bad ways to solve them by taking a gun and going to school. And unfortunately, they make news. And I think maybe that's part of what we've got to think about, is not getting so much media attention on these, but also not letting kids have so much access to guns. I think that is a very real issue, and it's shown up very clearly here in our own state. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I will just say, here we go again, and we pretty much know how this is going to come out. I do hope the authors will consider some changes. I know that there are folks talking to the governor about some changes, and that she'll at least keep an open ear to that. It's clear this is going to go through, but I think we've got to think about the soul of the state. We've got to think about the kids of the state. We've got to think about the safety of the state. And what is a bill that's going to pass? Right now, I guess our only hope is making it a better bill. We realize that because we know we can't defeat it. That you'll at least consider that.
Representative Howes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I just want to make a couple statements before we... Obviously, all day today, we could choose to wax eloquently and say what we want to say. But I do need to say that this legislation does not make it... It makes it, for me, from northern Minnesota, the Citizens Personal Protection Act, more difficult to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon. So when this bill was first brought up many, many years ago, I had reservations because the people in Cass County, their law-abiding citizens, could get a permit. I got my permit in 15 minutes. Went in, applied, gave the sheriff my money, and he gave me the little card enclosed in plastic. And I did talk to him about this bill. He supported the new concealed carry bill, said it made sense for the whole state, even though it would make it more difficult and more expensive for people in my district. So I supported it. This legislation has been on the books for almost 2 years. I've never preached that this would stop crime or lessen crime, but this legislation has not increased gun violence. It has not increased crime. I think it was said on the floor in 2003 that over 100,000 people would register to get a concealed permit, and 20,000 a year after that, we'd have 250,000 guns on the street, within 4 years. We have a little over 25,000 permit holders. Again, there have been no gun violence by permit holders. And, you know, we vote on many, many contentious issues, many difficult issues. And I do have to say this, and bear with me. Two of the issues I voted on, one is concealed carry, the other one is light rail. And I'm saddened to say that light rail has caused 2 deaths. Concealed carry has caused none. It is not more likely that we will have more crime with this bill, because we haven't. Another testifier made a statement that this will put more guns in the home. One of the people that came down here and testified against the bill has 16 guns in his home. I don't think that there was any effect of this bill one way or the other that had him have 16 guns. The bill also doesn't have anything with more gun ownership. A person can buy a gun without this legislation. So that doesn't change. It makes it a fair, level playing field across the state of Minnesota for people to be issued a permit if they're law-abiding citizens. And with regard to religion and churches, I don't feel that we're saying to churches that they can't worship. We're not saying that at all. We're saying if churches would like to tell someone to leave if they have a weapon, that they can do that. You know, and my daughter is a daughter of the American Revolution. And my family's been here since before the Revolution. And I know we fought the British from not only behind the churches and around the churches, but from inside the churches. So I don't think that this affects the churches. When I was in church this last Sunday in Brooklyn Center, and sometimes when I'm listening to the sermon, there are little light pauses where your mind wanders, and I obviously wandered to today, and walking out, there was a security officer there with a Glock on his hip and a little badge, and I asked him, "Are you a police officer?" He said, "No, I'm a security officer." I said, "Do you have a permit to carry?" He says, "Yes, I do." "Why are you here?" "The church just asked me to be here. 3,000 people attend every day or every Sunday." He just said, "You could see the amount of people, the church asked me to be here." And I said, you don't need any special permission." He said, "Well, yes, I had to get permission from the superintendent of the school because the school is attached to the church." So he has done everything according to the law, and there hasn't been any problems. And with regard to the comment about the NRA, I have not been contacted by the NRA. I haven't talked to the NRA for probably 2-3 years, anybody that represents the NRA. This is not an NRA bill. This is the right thing to do. If we reenact this and the governor signs it in the next 3 weeks, we also save the Attorney General and the Supreme Court time and money. And I believe that this is the right thing to do.
Jim Cornyn?
I think I can do mine all with less than 5 minutes. First of all, Mr. Chair and members, a number of people have mentioned Red Lake. I might be the only one here that's actually worked on Red Lake, arrested people from Red Lake, partied with people from Red Lake, know the cop that was shot. And this or Recore or Columbine absolutely would not have been prevented by any amount of gun control laws. So this has really nothing to do with those situations. And I won't even throw gas on the fire to get into the argument what could have been done if somebody would have been armed. I'm just worried about the permit to carry bill today. The next thing is the minister that came down here. There is a lot more reference in the New Testament to defending yourself than there is the other way. And to say that I belong to the Missouri Lutheran Synod, and this morning when I was doing my Bible readings, ironically I come across Luke 22 where it said Jesus said to his disciples, "Sell your cloak and buy a sword." I don't think there's anywhere in the New Testament that he said you ever couldn't defend yourself, so a reference to religion and in this venue I don't think is proper. There were so many things. I want you to, if you would, concentrate on all the things that were said today we fear might happen. We fear might happen. Last 2 years ago, it was said the same thing. And Representative Slavik, I have to commend you on your testimony today. You didn't say anything insightful. You didn't say the sky was going to fall or anything like some of the colleagues in the past had. But nothing has come to fruition that said would happen. My sheriff said the suicides would go up. They didn't. There was other law enforcement people that said road rage would go up. It didn't. There was some people that said domestic abuse would go up because of the permit to carry. It did not. There are some, unfortunately and tragically, some people killed with domestic abuse, but it has nothing to do with the permit to carry or the Personal Protection Act. The signs, I personally wish we'd have never put them up in the first place, because even though we did it at business bequest, because what it does is say this is a gun-free zone. Criminals come in. A sign that's absolutely no good, whether it's in a courthouse or whether it's a business, if somebody is predisposed to commit a horrific crime, I think Representative Ableton, you would probably even agree with me on this. If somebody is that twisted, or he's thinking of, or she, going in and shooting somebody, are they going to be worried about a petty misdemeanor walking by a sign or a gross misdemeanor? They're just going to walk by the sign and shoot somebody. So the signs that do no good. A lot of this stuff we put in this bill was actually feel-good things and negotiations made to make the people feel better, knowing that it was not going to do any good. We negotiated item after item to get the bill passed. The League of Cities, we preempted that. We didn't want a hodgepodge patchwork of laws with every city in having a different law, and that's why the preemption was put in there. We didn't want more questions on the form, because the questions have a way of discriminatory like they used to be. You had to prove this, you had to prove that. All we want is a person that's a law-abiding citizen to come in and be able to carry a handgun. And now all the protections we put in, no training was required before, now training is required and has to be classroom and the range, actually hands-on. You know, you can't have over a 0.04 blood alcohol limit. You can't go into K-12. I really take issue with the superintendent. I was an involved parent on the school grounds many times. I gave firearms training on school grounds, which was well attended. At the prom, you talk about Red Lake. 30 miles from Red Lake is a high school where all my kids went together. At a prom party, after lockup prom party, you know what the prize was for the raffle? An 870 Wingmaster shotgun that was given to the student at the prom. So people have a lot of different ideas about school grounds, but there is no history. A lot of the things that you heard today were fear of something happened, but they have not happened. This is a good law, and the reason we don't want to put amendments on it is because once you open that floodgate and every group wanting this or that, we did that. Hours and hours and days, we think we have a really good law. We'd like to pass it, let it cook for a couple more years, and then address some of the things like off-duty cops. And the sheriff misrepresented that. If you go by and see an actual crime committed, the legal opinion that I've seen is that you can take action. The problem with the law that he's talking about is with carrying off-duty, because it says you have to be in the performance of your official duties. Now, Jim Franklin, who I've had conversations with before, in the meantime, in a way to manage this, is in contracts between labor and management, they can make statements in the contract like you're on duties 24/7, and that would put them in the official capacity and they could carry. So there's ways to manage this until we get an overall fix after a while, but I think it's a good bill, and I would urge you to vote for it, and in another year we can come back and make some of these changes you were talking about. So thank you.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to support the bill, I guess my problem with it is that, you know, if the problem with the old law, or the law that exists now, was that it was arbitrary, and maybe it should be not arbitrary. Maybe there should be some objective standards as to where and when a petition shall issue. But I still think the problem is that. One big problem is that where it's carried. Once you get a permit to carry, the question of where you can go with it, to me, is it should be an open question. Yet this law prescribes where you can go and talks about what you have to do if you don't want people to come on your property with this thing. So, I mean, I wish we would just deal with the objective criteria problem and leave the where you can carry it aside and maybe have a full-flung debate on that and let the community be involved, because maybe the criteria should be objective, but bringing it in people's places where they don't want you to have it and then requiring them to put up a sign if they don't want it there, I think imposes a burden upon property owners, and it's not a fair one. And I actually was very struck by what Mr. Lee Litch said, because you know, I represent big sections of downtown Minneapolis, and I can hardly imagine what folks from out of town think when they see all of our signs. I think it makes our buildings uglier, and I think it raises questions about the safety of our city that need not be raised. So I wish we could just deal with these things piecemeal, but we can't. You know, I own two guns. I own a shotgun and a rifle, and you know, I know how to use them. My teenage boys know how to use them. My wife knows how to use it. No problem with that. But I guess, you know, so I'm not unfamiliar with guns. I come from a part of town where we've had about 11 murders out of the 13 in the city of Minneapolis. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, where I think one year we had about 300 murders right in my neighborhood. And I attended a lot of funerals, and I attended some this year, too. I don't know why people are so afraid they feel they need to carry guns so much. They're not going to protect you, not really. If somebody has a drop on you, it doesn't matter whether you have a gun on you or not. You're going to get out of there. And I mean, and the thing is that just, I don't really understand what the fear is all about. I wish somebody would help me understand it. I mean, you know, what we're being told is that business people don't like it. Some don't. Law enforcement people may not oppose the bill, but they got problems with it the way it exists now. Faith groups have a problem with it. Why do we have to rush this thing? Why can't we just slow down a little bit and really work this thing out better, so that we can focus on some objective criteria, deal with where people can carry these things, and do something that we can more or less
all live with. I am concerned about the level of fear we have. That's what drives this bill, in my opinion. People are scared to death of each other, and they think a gun is going to protect them. And it just isn't. It couldn't possibly. And I do fear the direction we're going in here, because there's no protection in that gun. So I'll be voting against the bill. I know it's going to pass, but whatever.
Representative Westbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a question for the authors, one of the two, relating to gun safety and practices that are in rural Minnesota certainly are different, at least in many areas than metro. But is it going to now strictly be prohibited from using the school grounds or a school classroom in the summer to conduct a gun safety course? I mean, because that's a common place, a community place, that a lot of things happen beyond just the 8-to-5 classroom. Is there a way that can still occur if the school administration works with the instructors?
Mr. Chairman, members, as far as I can tell, there's no restrictions on in this bill of having guns in schools for firearms training or academies or things like that, because there's some schools that actually have firearms as part of their training, military academies and this and that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, just a couple of closing comments. Representative Ellison talks about why do it. Representative Ellison, for no other reason, to uphold our oath of office and to follow the Constitution. Our forefathers didn't say take guns away from law-abiding citizens, and that's probably the basic reason, Mr. Chair, members, that I think you ought to give due consideration. Representative Howes said the same thing I had concerns about, have concerns about, is this actually makes it tougher in many of my areas, Mr. Chair, committee members, to get a handgun permit. I've got sheriffs in my district and around my district that will tell me year in and year out they've never had somebody with a permit be a problem or be the suspect when they're called out to a violent situation. And for us to fearmonger this, like Representative Slavik was talking about, is just unfounded. The numbers aren't there that we were told 2 years ago were going to be applied for. The chaos isn't there. The chaos is there whether the law-abiding citizens have the ability to get concealed carry permit or not, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is not a step backwards. This is a step for the freedom, for the upholding the Constitution of our United States, our forefathers are put into place, and we're not sanctioning any unlawful behavior, because they're not the ones getting the permits anyways. Go to my district, talk to my sheriffs. The ones carrying the permits, and you can talk to your sheriffs, they're not coming in for the permits anyways. The Atlanta courthouse shooter, we all know about that case. Do you think he would have stopped with a sign posted, don't carry your gun beyond here? Do you think he would have stopped because somebody said you don't have a permit to carry your gun? That's not how the criminals operate. We could have all the laws in the book. We aren't going to stop those scenarios. And so this doesn't have anything to do with expanding those problems. And just a final point, Representative Slawick, you talked about you don't want kids to have exposure to the guns. You don't want them to see more guns around. Well, education is good. Governor Ventura probably said it best when he was in office and said, guns are a dangerous thing. You ought to be trained and taught how to respect them, just like we train and teach kids how to respect automobiles, how to drive automobiles. There's lots of dangerous things in this world if you don't have proper training and aren't taught to respect them up front. And that's simply what this bill allows to do, and that makes a statewide standard. So what citizens in my district in several counties are able to be entitled to, other citizens that for reasons without merit are discriminated against, won't be discriminated against anymore.
Members, just for your information, we have informed the Speaker's office that we may go a few minutes past 12, and they're not going to, I don't think they're going to start session without us. So, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to speak on behalf of this bill, not on behalf of myself, but on behalf of a constituent. His name is Elmer, and he lives in Hugo, and he is a veteran of the Korean War. And he, in Washington County, applied for a permit, and he went through all of the training. He bought all the coursework, bought the special ammunition, and went through everything that you have to go through to obtain a permit, and he was denied. And he brought this to my attention because he said that he had to travel in some cases with money, with cash. He felt unsafe, and he wanted that protection. And he said, you know, don't you really think it's ironic that our country trusted me with a gun in Korea when I was getting shot at? We had to shoot people. And now I come back, I feel like I need that protection again when other people in different parts of the state can have that. He's an elderly guy, and he can't get it. He said, don't you think it's ironic that they trusted me then, but they don't trust me now? And that's when it really kind of hit home for me. And Mr. Kale brought up a similar instance with a Iraq veteran. And I think that that really kind of hit home for me, the fairness issue and the equity issue. And, you know, Elmer is just looking for a little bit more protection because he feels unsafe because of some of the work that he's doing. I would remind everybody that there are some safety concerns with what we do here at the Capitol, and we are protected. We don't have to bring a gun because we are being protected currently right now by a person carrying a weapon. He's right back there, and he wears a purple coat. Whenever you see those folks around, I just ask them, and they do carry guns. And I think that that we are protected by that. I think that Elmer deserves that same level of protection, and so I would speak on behalf of this bill, but more to the point, on behalf of Elmer and my district. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to keep it short because a lot of the good stuff's been said, and actually on both sides. And I want to say I know that the authors have in mind what they think is best for Minnesota. I don't doubt their motives or their good intentions. But I think that the idea here of sort of deterrence or personal protection that comes from making it easier through this bill to get a permit is an interesting idea in theory, but what if we were to apply that not just in our own lives or in the state of Minnesota, what if we were to apply that globally and think in terms of foreign policy? What if we were to say, you know, it's a dangerous world, let's give nuclear weapons to everyone. That way, it'll be sort of mutual deterrence across the board. Let's not just have a few countries have nuclear weapons. Let's give it to Cameroon and Rwanda and Cambodia and Uruguay and Jamaica. And let's just make it easier, and it will restrict the amount of conflict in the world because no one will dare encroach upon the borders of another for fear that deadly force will be used. I don't think there's anyone of us in this room who would endorse anything like that. And the analogy isn't a perfect one, but I think it's somewhat apt, the idea that the more you have, the more secure people are. And I don't think that is a good idea. I think most people wouldn't need it. I agree with what Representative Ellison said, and I think some of the questions at the beginning kind of pointed this out. It seems to me that the real problem or the real objection, at least early on, by proponents here, was the arbitrariness or the discrimination, perceived or real or whatever, that existed in the permitting process. And it seems to me that a better way to address this project or this problem would be to do that, address the arbitrariness, address the discrimination without going this far. That seems to be the better route to go. One other point about the signs, too. A friend of mine works at a local university here, and he was telling me a story about how the faculty there was trying to woo some hotshot scholar from Chicago, flew her in and wined her and dined her to see if she'd make the switch from her institution to the one here in the Twin Cities. And she was staying downtown Minneapolis. She was staying at a hotel, and a few bigwigs from the university went over and walked her over to some fancy restaurant in downtown Minneapolis. And at the end of the evening, this person who they were trying to woo said, "Can I ask you something? What's with all these gun signs? Is there some big problem here? You know, what's going on here? It gives me some pause." And the moral of the story isn't just that she didn't come, although I'm sure that wasn't the reason. But the moral of the story is that he reported that the other administrators and the people at the university were frankly embarrassed, that they had to explain away that, no, don't worry, we don't have a problem, don't worry, this isn't a reflection on our community, this is just some law that the legislature passed that forces property owners to register their disapproval rather than the other way around when it comes to firearms in their businesses. And I think that's too bad, and that's not something we have to think about. And Representative Cornish, I understand your, you know, practical political concern, and Representative Howes, you too. I know you guys have been working on this for years, and I respect that. And in the legislative process and the give and take, you know, I take your word that the business community, you say, actually wanted that at the beginning, and you got to give a little to get a little, and I understand that. But practically speaking, I think the signs tend to send a message to people that's unfortunate. I don't know how we get around that. But it is something that's unfortunate. I think the bottom line for me is that there are other better ways to address some of the flaws or the faults in the system as you perceive them than this bill. So I respectfully oppose the bill.
Representative DeForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, your analogy, I'll agree, is somewhat apt. I thought it was interesting if we had a Minnesota PPA standard internationally for nuclear weapons, maybe nations like North Korea wouldn't have one. I could only wish that we would have a scheme whereby nations would have to apply to some higher authority to prove that they were responsible stewards of nuclear weapons. And members, I apologize today. I know Representatives Broad, Nelson, and myself have a tax committee meeting as well, and fortunately that's the nature of legislative schedules these days. But I assume Representative Howes has mentioned these statistics, and I believe that he can prove me wrong or tell me I'm wrong, that those who obtained permits under the 2003 scheme were found to be no less law-abiding than those who obtained permits under the previous scheme. Is that correct? Okay. I think that speaks for itself. I know we've heard a lot of talk about other issues, and I will simply end my comments at that. I've read the comments from some of my constituents and others. This isn't an issue of the sale or transfer of weapons. It has nothing to do with assault weapons. I'm sure those arguments have been covered, and so I think there's absolutely nothing wrong from a public policy perspective of honoring Second Amendment rights. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Well, let me just add then that I think we have a pretty unique opportunity today that I don't know we see very often in the legislature, where we have before us a very controversial bill with, and we've been told it's going to have a lot of dire consequences, and we get to vote on that having had the opportunity of actually seeing the bill in law and determining whether those dire consequences are going to occur or not. And I did not hear a single solitary example today of anything negative that came of this law in the last 2 years. I certainly have not read of anything negative in the papers about this. I have read a few positive stories about people thwarting crime or avoiding violence because of it. But we have seen no one killed, we've seen no one injured, we have not seen, I don't believe, any accidental shootings based upon people who have gained permits that would not have gotten them before. So really, this isn't a philosophical debate anymore, because we know conclusively what will happen and what won't happen when we essentially repass this law. And I believe, had we seen in the last couple of years some of those dire predictions come true, if we turned into the Wild West or seen murder and mayhem in the street as we were told was going to happen, most of us would have great pause about voting for this bill. But we know conclusively now that none of those negative things are going to happen. So we have a bill that makes the law more fair. It makes the state safer because of training requirements and some other provisions. It is stricter with respect to schools and daycare centers, two things that I care about very much, little kids. And I believe, based upon what we've seen, we made a pretty good decision 2 years ago, and we ought to reaffirm that today. I'll give the last word to Representative Howes if you have anything to add.
Well, I would simply like to thank the chairman for making arrangements to have this bill heard, and thank all members on both sides for deliberating this bill today and being patient with me, and we're all holding our remarks
gentle remarks that we've made today, and we will discuss this bill at a later time. But thank you.
Members, a roll call has been requested, so I will ask Ms. Rogers to take a roll.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative DeVilforest?
Yes.
Representative Broad?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Ellison?
Nope.
Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Representative Hilty?
No.
Representative Lesh?
Nay.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Slawik?
No.
Representative Westrom?
Yes.
I forgot to restate my motion that that House File 2428, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Rules. The motion prevails on a vote of 7-5. I believe, members, this will be our last meeting, so I do want to thank all the staff that have been, both the partisan staff and the nonpartisan staff, as well as Toby, our page. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.